In memory of Surendra Patel. We miss you, my friend.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Under the Dome, a novel by Stephen King. Read by Raul Esparza.
Who are you looking for? What was his name? You can probably find him at the football game. It's a small town. You know what I mean. It's a small town, son. And we all support the team. James McMurtry. The Airplane and the Woodchuck. 1. From 2,000 feet, where Claudette Sanders was taking a flying lesson, the town of Chester's Mill gleamed in the morning light like something freshly made and just set down. Cars trundled along Main Street, flashing up winks of sun. The steeple of the Congo Church looked sharp enough to pierce the unblemished sky. The sun raced along the surface of Presteel Stream as the Seneca 5 overflew it, both plane and water cutting the town on the same diagonal course.
Chuck! I think I see two boys beside the Peace Bridge, fishing.
Her very delight made her laugh. The flying lessons were courtesy of her husband, who was the town's first selectman. Although of the opinion that if God had wanted man to fly, he would have given him wings, Andy was an extremely coaxable man, and eventually Claudette had gotten her way. She had enjoyed the experience from the first, but this wasn't mere enjoyment, it was exhilaration. Today was the first time she had really understood what made flying great, what made it cool. Chuck Thompson, her instructor, touched the control yoke gently, then pointed at the instrument panel.
"I'm sure," he said, "but let's keep the shiny side up, Claudie, okay?"
Sorry.
"Not at all."
He had been teaching people to do this for years. And he liked students like Claudie, the ones who were eager to learn something new. She might cost Andy Sanders some real money before long. She loved the Seneca, and had expressed a desire to have one just like it, only new. That would run somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. Although not exactly spoiled, Claudie Sanders had undeniably expensive tastes, which, lucky man, Andy seemed to have no trouble satisfying. Chuck also liked days like this. Unlimited visibility, no wind, perfect teaching conditions. Nevertheless, the Seneca rocked slightly as she overcorrected.
"You're losing your happy thoughts. Don't do that. Come to 120. Let's go out Route 119 and drop on down to 900.
She did. The Seneca's trim once more perfect. Chuck relaxed. They passed above Jim Rennie's used cars, and then the town was behind them. There were fields on either side of 119 and trees burning with color. The Seneca's cruciform shadow fled up the blacktop, one dark wing briefly brushing over an ant-man with a pack on his back. The ant-man looked up and waved. Chuck waved back, although he knew the guy couldn't see him.
"Beautiful goddamn day,"
Claudie exclaimed. Chuck laughed. Their lives had another 40 seconds to run.
2.
The woodchuck came bumbling along the shoulder of Route 119, headed in the direction of Chester's Mill, although the town was still a mile and a half away, and even Jim Rennie's used cars was only a series of twinkling sun flashes arranged in rows at the place where the highway curved to the left. The chuck planned, so far as a woodchuck can be said to plan anything, to head back into the woods long before he got that far. But for now, the shoulder was fine. He'd come farther from his burrow than he meant to, but the sun had been warm on his back, and the smells were crisp in his nose, forming rudimentary images, not quite pictures, in his brain. He stopped and rose on his back paws for an instant. His eyes weren't as good as they used to be, but good enough to make out a human up there, walking in his direction on the other shoulder. The chuck decided he'd go a little farther anyway. Humans sometimes left behind good things to eat.
He was an old fellow, and a fat fellow. He had raided many garbage cans in his time, and knew the weight of the Chester's Mill landfill as well as he knew the three tunnels of his own burrow. Always good things to eat at the landfill. He waddled a complacent old fellow's waddle, watching the human walking on the other side of the road. The man stopped. The Chuck realized he had been spotted. To his right and just ahead was a fallen birch. He would hide under there, wait for the man to go by, then investigate for any tasty... The Chuck got that far in his thoughts, and another three waddling steps, although he had been cut in two. Then he fell apart on the edge of the road. Blood squirted and pumped. Guts tumbled into the dirt. His rear legs kicked rapidly twice, then stopped. His last thought before the darkness that comes to us all, Chucks and humans alike, what happened? 3. All the needles on the control panel dropped dead.
What the hell?
Claudie Sanders said. She turned to Chuck. Her eyes were wide, but there was no panic in them, only bewilderment. There was no time for panic. Chuck never saw the control panel. He saw the Seneca's nose crumple toward him. Then he saw both propellers disintegrate. There was no time to see more. No time for anything. The Seneca exploded over Route 119 and rained fire on the countryside. It also rained body parts. A smoking forearm, Claudette's, landed with a thump beside the neatly divided woodchuck. It was October 21st. Barbie. 1. Barbie started feeling better as soon as he passed Food City and left downtown behind. When he saw the sign reading, "You are leaving the village of Chester's Mill. Come back real soon," he felt better still. He was glad to be on his way, and not just because he had taken a pretty good beating in the mill. It was plain old moving on that had lightened him up. He'd been walking around under his own little gray cloud for at least 2 weeks before getting his shit handed to him in the parking lot of Dippers. "Basically, I'm just a rambling guy," he said, and laughed. "A rambling guy on his way to the big sky." And hell, why not? Montana. Or Wyoming. Fucking Rapid City, South Dakota. Any place but here. He heard an approaching engine. Turned around, walking backward now, and stuck out his thumb. What he saw was a lovely combination. A dirty old Ford pick-em-up with a fresh young blonde behind the wheel. Ash blonde, his favorite blonde of all. Barbie offered his most engaging smile. The girl driving the pick-em-up responded with one of her own, and oh my lord, if she was a TikTok over 19, he'd eat his last paycheck from Sweetbriar Rose. Too young for a gentleman of 30 summers, no doubt, but perfectly street legal, as they'd said back in the days of his corn-fed Iowa youth. The truck slowed. He started toward it, and then it sped up again. She gave him one more brief look as she went past. The smile was still in her face, but it had turned regretful. "I had a brain cramp there for a minute," the smile said, "but now sanity has reasserted itself." And Barbie thought he recognized her a little, although it was impossible to say with certainty. Sunday mornings in Sweetbriar were always a madhouse. But he thought he'd seen her with an older man, probably her dad, both of them with their faces mostly buried in sections of the Sunday Times. If he could have spoken to her as she rolled past, Barbie would have said, "If you trusted me to cook your sausage and eggs, surely you can trust me for a few miles in the shotgun seat." But, of course, he didn't get the chance. So he simply raised his hand in a little no-offense-taken salute. The truck's taillights flickered, as if she were reconsidering. Then they went out, and the truck sped up. During the following days, as things in the mill started going from bad to worse, he would replay this little moment in the warm October sun again and again. It was that second reconsidering flicker of the taillights he thought of, as if she had recognized him, after all. "That's the cook from Sweetbriar Rose, I'm almost sure. Maybe I ought to..." But maybe was a gulf better men than him had fallen into. If she had reconsidered, everything in his life thereafter would have changed. Because she must have made it out.
He never saw the fresh-faced blonde or the dirty old Ford F-150 again. She must have crossed over the Chester's Mill town line minutes, or even seconds, before the border slammed shut. If he'd been with her, he would have been out. And safe. Unless, of course, he'd think later, when sleep wouldn't come, the stop to pick me up was just long enough to be too long. In that case, I probably still wouldn't be here. And neither would she. Because the speed limit out that way on 119 is 50 miles an hour. And at 50 miles an hour, at this point, he would always think of the plane. 2. The plane flew over him just after he passed Jim Rennie's used cars, a place for which Barbie had no love. Not that he'd bought a lemon there. He hadn't owned a car in over a year, had sold the last one in Punta Gorda, Florida. It was just that Jim Rennie Jr. had been one of the fellows that night in Dipper's parking lot. A frat boy with something to prove. And what he could not prove alone, he would prove as part of a group. That was the way the Jim Juniors of the world did business, in Barbie's experience. But it was behind him now. Jim Rennie's, Jim Jr., Sweetbriar Rose, fried clams our specialty, always whole, never strips. Angie McCain, Andy Sanders, the whole deal, including dippers. Beatings administered in the parking lot, our specialty. All behind him. And ahead of him, why, the gates of America. Goodbye, small town Maine, hello, big sky. Or maybe, hell, he'd head down south again. No matter how beautiful this particular day, winter was lurking a page or two over on the calendar. The South might be good. He'd never been to Muscle Shoals, and he liked the sound of the name. That was goddamn poetry, Muscle Shoals was. And the idea so cheered him that when he heard the little plane approaching, he looked up and gave a big old exuberant wave. He hoped for a wing waggle in return, but didn't get one, although the plane was slow-poking at low altitude. Barbie's guess was sightseers. This was a day for them, with the trees in full flame. Or maybe some young kid on his learner's permit, too worried about screwing up to bother with groundlings like Dale Barbara. But he wished them well. Sightseers, or a kid still 6 weeks from his first solo cruise, Barbie wished them very well. It was a good day, and every step away from Chester's Mill made it better. Too many assholes in the mill, and besides, travel was good for the soul. Maybe moving on in October should be a law, he thought. New national motto, everybody leaves in October. You get your packing permit in August, give your required week's notice in mid-September, then... He stopped. Not too far ahead of him, on the other side of the blacktop highway, was a woodchuck. A damned fat one. Sleek and sassy, too. Instead of scurrying off into the high grass, it was coming on ahead. There was a fallen birch sticking its top half out onto the shoulder of the road, and Barbie was betting the woodchuck would scurry under there and wait for the big bad two legs to go by. If not, they would pass each other like the rambling guys they were. The one on four legs headed north, the one on two headed south. Barbie hoped that would happen. It would be cool. These thoughts went through Barbie's mind in seconds. The shadow of the airplane was still between him and the chuck, a black cross racing along the highway. Then two things happened, almost simultaneously. The first was the woodchuck. It was whole, then it was in two pieces. Both were twitching and bleeding. Barbie stopped, mouth hanging open on the suddenly lax hinge of his lower jaw. It was as if an invisible guillotine blade had dropped. And that was when, directly above the severed woodchuck, the little airplane exploded. 3. Barbie looked up. Falling from the sky was a squashed, bizarro world version of the pretty little airplane that had passed over him seconds before. Twisting orange-red petals of fire hung above it in the air. A flower that was still opening, an American disaster rose. Smoke billowed from the plummeting plane. Something clanged to the road and sprayed up clods of asphalt before spinning drunkenly into the high grass to the left. A propeller. If that had bounced my way. Barbie had a brief image of being cut in two, like the unfortunate woodchuck, and turned to run. Something thudded down in front of him, and he screamed. But it wasn't the other propeller. It was a man's leg dressed in denim. He could see no blood, but the side seam had been blown wide open, revealing white flesh and wiry black hair. There was no foot attached. Barbie ran in what felt like slow motion. He saw one of his own feet, clad in an old scuffed work boot, stride out and clop down. Then it disappeared behind him as his other foot strode out, all slow, slow, like watching the baseball replay of a guy trying to steal second. There was a tremendous hollow clang from behind him, followed by the boom of a secondary explosion, followed by a blast of heat that struck him from heels to nape. It shoved him on his way like a warm hand. Then all thoughts blew away, and there was nothing but the body's brute need to survive. Dale Barbara ran for his life. 4. 100 yards or so down the road, the big warm hand became a ghost hand. Although the smell of burning gas, plus a sweeter stench that had to be a mixture of melting plastic and roasting flesh, was strong, carried to him on a light breeze. Barbie ran another 60 yards, then stopped and turned around. He was panting. He didn't think it was the running. He didn't smoke, and he was in good shape. Well, fair. His ribs on the right side still hurt from the beating in Dipper's parking lot. He thought it was terror and dismay. He could have been killed by falling pieces of airplane, not just the runaway propeller, or burned to death. It was only blind luck that he hadn't been. Then he saw something that made his rapid breathing stop in mid-gasp. He straightened up, looking back at the site of the accident. The road was littered with debris. It really was a wonder that he hadn't been struck and at least wounded. A twisted wing lay on the right. The other wing was poking out of the uncut timothy grass on the left, not far from where the runaway propeller had come to rest. In addition to the blue jeans-clad leg, he could see a severed hand and arm. The hand seemed to be pointing at a head, as if to say, "That's mine." A woman's head, judging from the hair. The power lines running beside the highway had been severed. They lay crackling and twisting on the shoulder. Beyond the head and arm was the twisted tube of the airplane's fuselage. Barbie could read NJ3. If there was more, it was torn away. But none of this was what had caught his eye and stopped his breath. The disaster rose was gone now, but there was still fire in the sky. Burning fuel, certainly, but it was running down the air in a thin sheet. Beyond it, and through it, Barbie could see the main countryside, still peaceful, not yet reacting, but in motion nevertheless, shimmering like the air over an incinerator or a burning barrel. It was as if someone had splashed gasoline over a pane of glass and then set it alight. Almost hypnotized, that was what it felt like anyway, Barbie started walking back toward the scene of the crash. 5. His first impulse was to cover the body parts, but there were too many. Now he could see another leg, this one in green slacks, and a female torso caught in a clump of juniper. He could pull off his shirt and drape it over the woman's head, but after that, well, there were 2 extra shirts in his backpack. Here came a car from the direction of Mauton, the next town to the south, one of the smaller SUVs, and moving fast. Someone had either heard the crash or seen the flash. Help. Thank God for help. Straddling the white line and standing well clear of the fire that was still running down from the sky and that weird water on a window paneway, Barbie waved his arms over his head, crossing them in big X's. The driver honked once in acknowledgement, then slammed on his brakes, laying 40 feet of rubber. He was out almost before his little green Toyota had stopped, a big, rangy fellow with long gray hair cascading out from under a sea dog's baseball cap. He ran toward the side of the road, meaning to skirt the main firefall.
"What happened?" he cried. "What in the blue fu—"
Then he struck something. Hard. There was nothing there, but Barbie saw the guy's nose snap to the side as it broke. The man rebounded from the nothing, bleeding from the mouth, nose, and forehead. He fell on his back, then struggled to a sitting position. He stared at Barbie with dazed, wondering eyes as blood from his nose and mouth cascaded down the front of his work shirt. And Barbie stared back. Junior and Angie. 1. The two boys fishing near the Peace Bridge didn't look up when the plane flew overhead, but Junior Rennie did. He was a block farther down, on Prestille Street, and he recognized the sound. It was Chuck Thompson's Seneca 5. He looked up, saw the plane, then dropped his head fast when the bright sunlight shining through the trees sent a bolt of agony in through his eyes. Another headache. He'd been having a lot of them lately. Sometimes the medication killed them. Sometimes, especially in the last 3 or 4 months, it didn't. Migraines, Dr. Haskell said. All Junior knew was that they hurt like the end of the world, and bright light made them worse, especially when they were hatching. Sometimes he thought of the ants he and Frank the Lesseps had burned up when they were just kids. He used a magnifying glass and focused the sun on them as they crawled in and out of their hill. The result was fricasseed formicants. Only these days, when one of his headaches was hatching, his brain was the anthill and his eyes turned into twin magnifying glasses. He was 21. Did he have this to look forward to until he was 45 or so, when Dr. Haskell said they might let up? Maybe. But this morning a headache wasn't going to stop him. The sight of Henry McCain's Forerunner, or LaDonna McCain's Prius in the driveway might have. In that case, he might have turned around, gone back to his own house, taken another Imitrex, and lain down in his bedroom with the shades drawn and a cool washcloth on his forehead, possibly feeling the pain start to diminish as the headache derailed, but probably not. Once those black spiders really got a foothold. He looked up again, this time squinting his eyes against the hateful light, but the Seneca was gone, and even the buzz of its engine, also aggravating, all sounds were aggravating when he was getting one of these bitch kitties, was fading. Chuck Thompson was some flyboy or flygirl wannabe. And although Junior had nothing against Chuck, hardly knew him, he wished with sudden childish ferocity that Chuck's pupil would fuck up big time and crash the plane. Preferably in the middle of his father's car dealership. Another sickish throb of pain twisted through his head. But he went up the steps to the McCain's door anyway. This had to be done. This was over-fucking-due. Angie needed a lesson. But just a little one, don't let yourself get out of control. As if summoned, his mother's voice replied, her maddeningly complacent voice. Junior was always a bad-tempered boy, but he keeps it under much better control now. Don't you, Junior? Well, gee, he had, anyway. Football had helped, but now there was no football. Now there wasn't even college. Instead, there were the headaches, and they made him feel like one mean motherfucker. Don't let yourself get out of control. No, but he would talk to her, headache or no headache. And as the old saying was, he just might have to talk to her by hand. Who knew? Making Angie feel worse might make him feel better. Junior rang the bell. 2. Angie McCain was just out of the shower. She slipped on a robe, belted it, then wrapped a towel around her wet hair. "Comin'," she called, as she not quite trotted down the stairs to the first floor. There was a little smile on her face. It was Frankie. She was quite sure it must be Frankie. Things were finally coming right side up. The bastardly short order cook, good-looking but still a bastard, had either left town or was leaving, and her parents were out. Combine the two, and you got a sign from God that things were coming right side up. She and Frankie could put all the crap in the rear view and get back together. She knew exactly how to handle it. Open the door, and then open her robe, right there in the Saturday morning daylight where anybody passing might see her. She'd make sure it was Frankie first, of course. She had no intention of flashing fat old Mr. Wicker if he'd rung the bell with a package or a registered mail, but it was at least half an hour too early for the mail. No, it was Frankie, she was sure. She opened the door, the little smile widening to a welcoming grin, perhaps not fortunate since her teeth were rather crammed together and the size of jumbo chiclets. One hand was on the tie of her robe, but she didn't pull it, because it wasn't Frankie, it was Junior, and he looked so angry. She had seen his black look before, many times, in fact, but never this black since eighth grade, when Junior broke the Dupree kid's arm. The little fag had dared to swish his bubble butt onto the town common basketball court and asked to play. And she supposed Junior must have had the same thunderstorm on his face that night in Dipper's parking lot. But of course she hadn't been there. She had only heard about it. Everybody in the mill had heard about it. She'd been called in to talk to Chief Perkins. That damn Barbie had been there. And eventually, that had gotten out too.
Junior? Junior, what?
Then he slapped her, and thinking pretty much ceased. 3. He didn't get much into that first one, because he was still in the doorway and there wasn't much room to swing. He could only draw his arm back to half-cock. He might not have hit her at all, at least not to start with, had she not been flashing a grin. God, those teeth. They'd given him the creeps even in grammar school. And if she hadn't called him Junior. Of course, everyone in town called him Junior. He thought of himself as Junior, but he hadn't realized how much he hated it, how much he hoped to die in a maggot pie hated it, until he heard it come bolting out from between the spooky tombstone teeth of the bitch who had caused him so much trouble. The sound of it went through his head like the sun glare when he'd looked up to see the plane. But as slaps from half-cock go, this one wasn't bad. She went stumbling backward against the newel post of the stairway, and the towel flew off her hair. Wet brown snaggles hung around her cheeks, making her look like Medusa. The smile had been replaced by a look of stunned surprise, and Junior saw a trickle of blood running from the corner of her mouth. That was good. That was fine. The bitch deserved to bleed for what she had done. So much trouble. Not just for him, but for Frankie and Mel and Carter, too. His mother's voice in his head. Don't let yourself get out of control, honey. She was dead, and still wouldn't stop giving advice. Teach her a lesson, but make it a little one. And he really might have managed to do that, but then her robe came open and she was naked underneath it. He could see the dark patch of hair over her breeding farm, her goddamn itchy breeding farm that was all the fucking trouble. When you got right down to it, those farms were all the fucking trouble in the world. And his head was throbbing, thudding, whamming, smashing, splitting. It felt like it was going to go thermonuclear at any moment. A perfect little mushroom cloud would shoot out of each ear just before everything exploded above the neck, and Junior Rennie, who didn't know he had a brain tumor, wheezy old Dr. Haskell had never even considered the possibility, not in an otherwise healthy young man hardly out of his teens, went crazy. It wasn't a lucky morning for Claudette Sanders or Chuck Thompson. In point of fact, it wasn't a lucky morning for anyone in Chester's Mill. But few were as unlucky as the ex-girlfriend of Frank de Lesseps. 4. She did have two more semi-coherent thoughts as she leaned against the newel post and looked at his bulging eyes and the way he was biting his tongue. Biting it so hard his teeth sunk into it.
He's crazy. I have to call the police before he really hurts me.
She turned to run down the front hall to the kitchen, where she would pull the handset off the wall phone, punch 911, and then just start screaming. She got two steps, then stumbled on the towel she'd wrapped around her hair. She regained her balance quickly. She had been a cheerleader in high school, and those skills hadn't left her. But it was still too late. Her head snapped back, and her feet flew out in front of her. He had grabbed her by her hair. He yanked her against his body. He was baking, as if with a high fever. She could feel his heartbeat, quick, quick, running away with itself. "You lying bitch!" he screamed directly into her ear. It sent a spike of pain deep into her head. She screamed herself. But the sound seemed faint and inconsequential compared to his. Then his arms were wrapped around her waist, and she was being propelled down the hall at a manic speed, nothing but her toes touching the carpet. Something went through her mind about being the hood ornament on a runaway car, and then they were in the kitchen, which was filled with brilliant sunshine. Junior screamed again, this time not with rage, but pain. 5. The light was killing him. It was frying his howling brains, but he didn't let it stop him. Too late for that now. He ran her straight into the formica-topped kitchen table without slowing. It struck her in the stomach, then slid and slammed into the wall. The sugar bowl and the salt and pepper went flying. Her breath escaped her in a big woofing sound. Holding her around the waist with one hand and by the wet snaggles of her hair with the other, Junior whirled her and threw her against the cold spot. She struck it with a bang that knocked off most of the fridge magnets. Her face was dazed and paper pale. Now she was bleeding from her nose as well as her lower lip. The blood was brilliant against her white skin. He saw her eyes shift toward the butcher block filled with knives on the counter, and when she tried to rise, he brought his knee into the center of her face, hard. There was a muffled crunching sound, as if someone had dropped a big piece of china, a platter, maybe, in another room. "It's what I should have done to Dale Barbara," he thought, and stepped back with the heels of his palms pressed against his throbbing temples. Tears from his watering eyes spilled down his cheeks. He had bitten his tongue badly. Blood was streaming down his chin and pattering on the floor, but Junior wasn't aware of it. The pain in his head was too intense. Angie lay face down among the fridge magnets. The largest said, "What goes in your mouth today shows up on your ass tomorrow." He thought she was out, but all at once she began to shiver all over. Her fingers trembled as if she were preparing to play something complex on the piano. "Only instrument this bitch ever played is the skin flute," he thought. Then her legs began to crash up and down, and her arms followed suit. Now Angie looked like she was trying to swim away from him. She was having a goddamn seizure. "Stop it," he shouted. Then, as she voided herself, "Stop it! Stop doing that, you bitch!" He dropped on his knees, one on each side of her head, which was now bobbing up and down. Her forehead repeatedly smacked the tile, like one of those camel jockeys saluting Allah. "Stop it! Fucking stop it!" She began to make a growling noise. It was surprisingly loud. Christ, what if someone heard her? What if he got caught here? This wouldn't be like explaining to his father why he'd left school, a thing Junior had not as yet been able to bring himself to do. This time, it would be worse than having his monthly allowance cut by 75% because of that goddamn fight with the cook, the fight this useless bitch had instigated. This time, Big Jim Rennie wouldn't be able to talk Chief Perkins and the local fuzznuts around. This could be... A picture of Shawshank State Prison's brooding green walls suddenly popped into his mind. He couldn't go there. He had his whole life ahead of him. But he would. Even if he shut her up now, he would. Because she'd talk later. And her face, which looked a lot worse than Barbie's had after the fight in the parking lot, would talk for her. Unless he shut her up completely. Junior seized her by the hair and helped her wham her head against the tiles. He was hoping it would knock her out so he could finish doing... well, whatever. But the seizure only intensified. She began beating her feet against the cold spot, and the rest of the magnets came down in a shower. He let go of her hair and seized her by the throat. Said, "I'm sorry, Ange, it wasn't supposed to happen like this." But he wasn't sorry. He was only scared and in pain, and convinced that her struggles in this horribly bright kitchen would never end. His fingers were already getting tired. Who knew it was so hard to choke a person? Somewhere far off to the south, there was a boom, as if someone had fired a very large gun. Junior paid no attention. What Junior did was redouble his grip, and at last Angie's struggles began to weaken. Somewhere, much closer by, in the house, on this floor, a low chiming began. He looked up, eyes wide, at first sure it was the doorbell. Someone had heard the ruckus, and the cops were here. His head was exploding. It felt like he had sprained all his fingers, and it had all been for nothing. A terrible picture flitted through his mind. Junior Rennie being escorted into the Castle County Courthouse for arraignment with some cop's sport coat over his head. Then he recognized the sound. It was the same chiming his own computer made when the electricity went out, and it had to switch over to battery power. Bing, bing, bing. Room service. Send me up a room, he thought, and went on choking. She was still now, but he kept at it for another minute with his head turned to one side, trying to avoid the smell of her shit. How like her to leave such a nasty going-away present? How like them all? Women. Women in their breeding farms. Nothing but anthills covered with hair. And they said men were the problem. 6. He was standing over her bloody, beshitted, and undoubtedly dead body, wondering what to do next, when there was another distant boom from the south. Not a gun. Much too big. An explosion. Maybe Chuck Thompson's fancy little airplane had crashed after all. It wasn't impossible. On a day when you set out just to shout at someone, read them the riot act a little, no more than that, and she ended up making you kill her, anything was possible. A police siren started yowling. Junior was sure it was for him. Someone had looked in the window and seen him choking her. It galvanized him into action. He started down the hall to the front door, got as far as the towel he'd knocked off her hair with that first slap, then stopped. They'd come that way. That was just the way they'd come. Pull up out front, those bright new LED flashers sending arrows of pain into the squalling meat of his poor brain. He turned around and ran back to the kitchen. He looked down before stepping over Angie's body. He couldn't help it. In first grade, he and Frank had sometimes pulled her braids, and she would stick her tongue out at them and cross her eyes. Now her eyes bulged from their sockets like ancient marbles, and her mouth was full of blood. Did I do that? Did I really? Yes, he had. And even that single fleeting look was enough to explain why. Her fucking teeth. Those humongous choppers. A second siren joined the first, then a third, but they were going away. Thank Christ, they were going away. They were heading south down Main Street, toward those booming sounds. Nevertheless, Junior did not slow down. He skulked across the McCain's backyard, unaware that he would have screamed guilt about something to anyone who happened to be watching. No one was. Beyond LaDonna's tomato plants was a high board fence and a gate. There was a padlock, but it was hanging open on the hasp. In his years of growing up and sometimes hanging out here, Junior had never seen it closed. He opened the gate. Beyond were scrub woods, and a path leading down to the muted babble of Presteel Stream. Once, when he was 13, Junior had spied Frank and Angie standing on that path and kissing, her arms around his neck, his hand cupping her breast, and understood that childhood was almost over. He leaned down and vomited into the running water. The sun dapples on the water were malicious, awful. Then his vision cleared enough so he could see the Peace Bridge to his right. The Fisher boys were gone, but as he looked, a pair of police cars raced down Town Common Hill. The town whistle went off. The town hall generator had kicked on just as it was supposed to during a power failure, allowing the whistle to broadcast its high decibel disaster message. Junior moaned and covered his ears. The Peace Bridge was really just a covered pedestrian walkway, now ramshackle and sagging. Its actual name was the Alvin Chester Pass-Through, but it had become the Peace Bridge in 1969, when some kids, at the time there had been rumors in town about which ones, had painted a big blue peace sign on the side. It was still there, although now faded to a ghost. For the last 10 years, Peace Bridge had been condemned. Police do not cross tape X'd both ends, but of course it was still used. 2 or 3 nights a week, members of Chief Perkins' Fuzznuts Brigade would shine their lights in there, always at one end or the other, never both. They didn't want to bust the kids who were drinking and necking, just scare them away. Every year, at town meeting, someone would move that Peace Bridge be demolished, and someone else would move that it be renovated, and both motions would be tabled. The town had its own secret will, it seemed. And that secret will wanted the Peace Bridge to stay just as it was. Today, Junior Rennie was glad of that. He shambled along the Prestille's northern bank until he was beneath the bridge. The police sirens now fading, the town whistle yelling as loud as ever, and climbed up to Strout Lane. He looked both ways, then trotted past the sign reading Dead End, Bridge Closed. He ducked under the crisscross of yellow tape into the shadows. The sun shone through the holy roof, dropping dimes of light on the worn wooden boards underfoot. But after the blaze of that kitchen from hell, it was blessedly dark. Pigeons sweet-talked in the roof beams. Beer cans and Allen's coffee-flavored brandy bottles were scattered along the wooden sides. I will never get away with this. I don't know if I left any of me under her nails, can't remember if she got me or not, but my blood's there. And my fingerprints. I only have two choices, really. Run, or turn myself in. No. There was a third. He could kill himself. He had to get home. Had to draw all the curtains in his room and turn it into a cave. Take another Imitrex, lie down, maybe sleep a little. Then he might be able to think. And if they came for him while he was asleep, why, that would save him the problem of choosing between door number one, door number two, or door number three. Junior crossed the town common. When someone, some old guy he only vaguely recognized, grabbed his arm and said, "What happened, Junior? What's going on?" Junior only shook his head, brushed the old man's hand away, and kept going. Behind him, the town whistle whooped like the end of the world. Highways and Byways. 1. There was a weekly newspaper in Chester's Mill called The Democrat, which was misinformation, since ownership and management, both hats worn by the formidable Julia Shumway, was Republican to the core. The masthead looked like this: The Chester's Mill Democrat, established 1890, serving the little town that looks like a boot. But the motto was misinformation, too. Chester's Mill didn't look like a boot. It looked like a kid's athletic sock so filthy it was able to stand up on its own. Although touched by the much larger and more prosperous Castle Rock to the southwest, the heel of the sock, the mill was actually surrounded by four towns larger in area but smaller in population. Motton to the south and southeast, Harlow to the east and northeast, the unincorporated TR-90 to the north, and Tarker's Mills to the west. Chester's and Tarker's were sometimes known as the Twin Mills, and between them, in the days when central and western Maine textile mills were running full bore, had turned Prestille Stream into a polluted and fishless sump that changed color almost daily and according to location. In those days, you could start out by canoe in Tarker's running on green water and be on bright yellow by the time you crossed out of Chester's Mill and into Motton. Plus, if your canoe was made of wood, the paint might be gone below the waterline. But the last of those profitable pollution factories had closed in 1979. The weird colors had left the Prestille, and the fish had returned, although whether or not they were fit for human consumption remained a matter of debate. The Democrat voted aye. The town's population was seasonal. Between Memorial Day and Labor Day, it was close to 15,000. The rest of the year, it was just a tad over or under two, depending on the balance of births and deaths at Catherine Russell, which was considered to be the best hospital north of Lewiston. If you asked the summer people how many roads led in and out of the mill, most would say there were two: Route 117, which led to Norway, South Paris, and Route 119, which went through downtown Castle Rock on its way to Lewiston. Residents of 10 years or so could have named at least eight more, all two-lane blacktop, from the Black Ridge and deep-cut roads that went into Harlow to the Pretty Valley Road, yes, just as pretty as its name, that wound north into TR-90. Residents of 30 years or more, if given time to mull it over, perhaps in the back room of Brownie's store where there was still a wood stove, could have named another dozen, with names both sacred, God Creek Road, and profane, Little Bitch Road, noted on local survey maps with nothing but a number. The oldest resident of Chester's Mill on what came to be known as Dome Day was Clayton Brassey. He was also the oldest resident of Castle County, and thus holder of the Boston Post cane. Unfortunately, he no longer knew what a Boston Post cane was, or even precisely who he was. He sometimes mistook his great-great-granddaughter, Nell, for his wife, who was 40 years dead, and the Democrat had stopped doing its yearly oldest resident interview with him 3 years previous. On the last occasion, when asked for the secret of his longevity, Clayton had responded, "Where's my Christing dinner?" Senility had begun to creep up shortly after his 100th birthday. On this October 21st, he was 105. He had once been a fine Finnish carpenter specializing in dressers, banisters, and moldings. His specialties in these latter days included eating jello pudding without getting it up his nose, and occasionally making it to the toilet before releasing half a dozen blood-streaked pebbles into the commode. But in his prime, around the age of 85, say, he could have named almost all the roads leading in and out of Chester's Mill, and the total would have been 34. Most were dirt, many were forgotten, and almost all of the forgotten ones wound through deep tangles of second-growth forest owned by Diamond Match, Continental Paper Company, and American Timber. And shortly before noon on Dome Day, every one of them snapped closed. 2. On most of these roads, there was nothing so spectacular as the explosion of the Seneca 5 and the ensuing pulp truck disaster. But there was trouble. Of course there was. If the equivalent of an invisible stone wall suddenly goes up around an entire town, there is bound to be trouble. At the same exact moment the woodchuck fell in two pieces, a scarecrow did the same in Eddie Chalmers's pumpkin field, not far from Pretty Valley Road. The scarecrow stood directly on the town line dividing the mill from TR-90. Its divided stance had always amused Eddie, who called his bird frightener the scarecrow without a country, Mr. Swack for short. Half of Mr. Swack fell in the mill. The other half fell on the TR, as the locals would have put it. Seconds later, a flight of crows bound for Eddie's pumpkins, the crows had never been afraid of Mr. Swack, struck something where nothing had ever been before. Most broke their necks and fell in black clumps on Pretty Valley Road and the fields on both sides. Birds everywhere, on both sides of the dome, crashed and fell dead. Their bodies would be one of the ways the new barrier was eventually delineated. On God Creek Road, Bob Rue had been digging potatoes. He came in for lunch, more commonly known as dinner in those parts, sitting astride his old Deere tractor and listening to his brand new iPod, a gift from his wife on what would prove to be his final birthday. His house was only half a mile from the field he'd been digging, but unfortunately for him, the field was in Motton, and the house was in Chester's Mill. He struck the barrier at 15 miles an hour while listening to James Blunt sing, "You're Beautiful." He had the loosest of grips on the tractor's steering wheel because he could see the road all the way to his house, and there was nothing on it. So, when his tractor came to a smash halt, the potato digger rising up behind and then crashing back down, Bob was flung forward over the engine block and directly into the dome. His iPod exploded in the wide front pocket of his bib overalls, but he never felt it. He broke his neck and fractured his skull on the nothing he collided with and died in the dirt shortly thereafter by one tall wheel of his tractor, which was still idling. Nothing, you know, runs like a deer. 3. At no point did the Motton Road actually run through Motton. It ran just inside the Chester's Mill town line. Here were new residential homes, in an area that had been called East Chester since 1975 or so. The owners were 30 and 40-somethings who commuted to Lewiston, Auburn, where they worked for good wages, mostly in white-collar jobs. All of these homes were in the mill, but many of their backyards were in Motton. This was the case with Jack and Myra Evans' home at 379 Motton Road. Myra had a vegetable garden behind their house, and although most of the goodies had been harvested, there were still a few fat Blue Hubbard squashes beyond the remaining and badly rotted pumpkins. She was reaching for one of these when the dome came down, and although her knees were in Chester's Mill, she happened to be reaching for a Blue Hubbard that was growing a foot or so across the Motton line. She didn't cry out because there was no pain. Not at first. It was too quick and sharp and clean for that. Jack Evans was in the kitchen, whipping eggs for a noontime frittata. LCD sound system was playing, North American Scum. And Jack was singing along when a small voice spoke his name from behind him. He didn't at first recognize the voice as belonging to his wife of 14 years. It sounded like the voice of a child. But when he turned, he saw it was indeed Myra. She was standing inside the doorway, holding her right arm across her middle. She had tracked mud onto the floor, which was very unlike her. Usually she took her garden shoes off on the stoop. Her left hand, clad in a filthy gardening glove, was cradling her right hand, and red stuff was running through the muddy fingers. At first he thought, cranberry juice, but only for a second. It was blood. Jack dropped the bowl he'd been holding. It shattered on the floor. Myra said his name again in that same tiny, trembling child voice. "What happened, Myra? What happened to you?"
"I had an accident," she said, and showed him her right hand.
Only there was no muddy right gardening glove to match the left one, and no right hand. Only a spouting stump. She gave him a weak smile and said,
"Whoops."
Her eyes rolled up to whites. The crotch of her gardening jeans darkened as her urine let go. Then her knees also let go, and she went down. The blood gushing from her raw wrist, an anatomy lesson cutaway, mixed with the eggy batter splattered across the floor. When Jack dropped to his knees beside her, a shard from the bowl jabbed deep into his knee. He hardly noticed, although he would limp on that leg for the rest of his life. He seized her arm and squeezed. The terrible blood gush from her wrist slowed, but didn't stop. He tore his belt free of its loops and noosed it around her lower forearm. That did the job, but he couldn't notch the belt tight. The loop was far beyond the buckle. "Christ!" he told the empty kitchen. "Christ!" It was darker than it had been, he realized. The power had gone out. He could hear the computer in the study chiming its distress call. LCD sound system was okay because the little boombox on the counter was battery-powered. Not that Jack cared any longer. He'd lost his taste for techno. So much blood. So much. Questions about how she'd lost her hand left his mind. He had more immediate concerns. He couldn't let go of the belt tourniquet to get to the phone. She'd start to bleed again, and she might already be close to bleeding out. She would have to go with him. He tried pulling her by her shirt, but first it yanked out of her pants, and then the collar started to choke her. He heard her breathing turn harsh. So he wrapped a hand in her long brown hair and hauled her to the phone, caveman style. It was a cell, and it worked. He dialed 911, and 911 was busy. "It can't be," he shouted to the empty kitchen, where the lights were now out, although from the boombox the band played on. 911 cannot be fucking busy. He punched redial. Busy. He sat in the kitchen with his back propped up against the counter, holding the tourniquet as tightly as he could, staring at the blood and the batter on the floor, periodically hitting redial on the phone, always getting the same stupid duh, duh, duh. Something blew up not too far distant, but he barely heard it over the music, which was really cranked. And he never heard the Seneca explosion at all. He wanted to turn the music off, but in order to reach the boombox, he would have to lift Myra, lift her, or let go of the belt for 2 or 3 seconds. He didn't want to do either one. So he sat there, and North American scum gave way to Someone Great, and Someone Great gave way to All My Friends, and after a few more songs, finally the CD, which was called Sound of Silver, ended. When it did, when there was silence except for police sirens in the distance and the endlessly chiming computer closer by, Jack realized that his wife was no longer breathing. "But I was going to make lunch," he thought. "A nice lunch. One you wouldn't be ashamed of inviting Martha Stewart to." Sitting against the counter, still holding the belt, opening his fingers again would prove exquisitely painful. The lower right leg of his own pants darkening with blood from his lacerated knee. Jack Evans cradled his wife's head against his chest and began to weep. 4. Not too far away, on an abandoned woods road not even old Clay Brassy would have remembered, a deer was foraging tender shoots at the edge of Presteel Marsh. Her neck happened to be stretched across the Motton town line, and when the dome dropped, Her head tumbled off. It was severed so neatly that the deed might have been done with a guillotine blade.
5.
We have toured the sock shape that is Chester's Mill and arrived back at Route 119. And, thanks to the magic of narration, not an instant has passed since the 60-ish fellow from the Toyota slammed face-first into something invisible, but very hard, and broke his nose. He's sitting up and staring at Dale Barbara in utter bewilderment. A seagull, probably on its daily commute from the tasty buffet at the Mottentown dump to the only slightly less tasty one at the Chester's Mill landfill, drops like a stone and thumps down not 3 feet from the 60-ish fellow's sea dog's baseball cap, which he picks up, brushes off, and puts back on. Both men look up at where the bird came from and see one more incomprehensible thing in a day that will turn out to be full of them. 6. Barbie's first thought was that he was looking at an afterimage from the exploding plane. The way you sometimes see a big blue floating dot after someone triggers a flash camera close to your face. Only this wasn't a dot, it wasn't blue, and instead of floating along when he looked in a different direction, in this case at his new acquaintance, the smutch hanging in the air stayed exactly where it was. Sea Dogs was looking up and rubbing his eyes. He seemed to have forgotten about his broken nose, swelling lips, and bleeding forehead. He got to his feet, almost losing his balance because he was craning his neck so severely. "What's that?" he said. "What the hell is that, mister?" A big black smear, candle flame-shaped, if you really used your imagination, discolored the blue sky. "Is it a cloud?" Sea Dogs asked. His doubtful tone suggested he already knew it wasn't. Barbie said, "I think..." He really didn't want to hear himself say this. "I think it's where the plane hit."
"Say what?"
Sea Dogs asked, but before Barbie could reply, a good-sized grackle swooped 50 feet overhead. It struck nothing, nothing they could see at any rate, and dropped not far from the gull. Sea Dogs said, "Did you see that?" Barbie nodded, then pointed to the patch of burning hay to his left. It, and the two or three patches on the right side of the road, were sending up thick columns of black smoke to join the smoke rising from the pieces of the dismembered Seneca. But the fire wasn't going far. There had been heavy rain the day before, and the hay was still damp. Lucky thing, or there would have been grass fires racing away in both directions.
"Do you see that?" Barbie asked Sea Dogs. "I'll be dipped in shit," Sea Dog said after taking a good long look.
The fire had burned a patch of ground about 60 feet square, moving forward until it was almost opposite the place where Barbie and Sea Dogs were facing one another, and there it spread, west to the edge of the highway, east into some small dairy farmer's 4 acres of grazeland, not raggedly, not the way grass fires normally advance, with the fire a bit ahead in one place and falling a little behind somewhere else, but as if on a straight edge. Another gull came flying toward them, this one bound for Motton rather than the mill.
"Look out," Sea Dog said. "Ware that bird."
"Maybe it'll be okay," Barbie said, looking up and shading his eyes. "Maybe whatever it is only stops them if they're coming from the south." "Judging by yonder busted plane, I doubt that," Sea Dog said. He spoke in the musing tones of a man who is deeply perplexed. The outbound gull struck the barrier and fell directly into the largest chunk of the burning plane.
"Stops them both ways," Sea Dog said.
He spoke in the tone of a man who has gotten confirmation of a strongly held but previously unproved conviction.
"It's some kind of force field, like in a Star Trek movie."
"Trek," Barbie said.
"Huh?"
"Oh, shit," Barbie said. He was looking over Sea Dog's shoulder.
"Huh?"
Sea Dog's looked over his own shoulder.
"Blue fuck."
A pulp truck was coming. A big one, loaded well past the legal weight limit with huge logs. It was also rolling well above the legal limit. Barbie tried to calculate what the stopping speed on such a behemoth might be and couldn't even guess.
Sea Dogs sprinted for his Toyota, which he'd left parked askew on the highway's broken white line. The guy behind the wheel of the pulper, maybe high on pills, maybe smoked up on meth, maybe just young, in a big hurry and feeling immortal, saw him and laid on his horn. He wasn't slowing.
"Fuck me sideways," Sea Dogs cried as he threw himself behind the wheel.
He keyed the engine and backed the Toyota out of the road with the driver's door flapping. The little SUV thumped into the ditch with its square nose canted up to the sky. Sea Dogs was out the next moment. He stumbled, landed on one knee, and then took off running into the field. Barbie, thinking of the plane and the birds, thinking of that weird black smutch that might have been the plane's point of impact, also ran into the Graysland, at first sprinting through low, unenthusiastic flames and sending up puffs of black ash. He saw a man's sneaker. It was too big to be a woman's, with the man's foot still in it. Pilot, he thought. And then, I have to stop running around like this.
"You idiot, slow down!" Sea Dogs cried at the pulp truck in a thin, panicky voice.
But it was too late for such instructions. Barbie, looking back over his shoulder, helpless not to, thought the pulp wrangler might have tried to brake at the last minute. He probably saw the wreckage of the plane. In any case, it wasn't enough. He struck the Motten side of the dome at 60 or a little more, carrying a log load of almost 40,000 pounds. The cab disintegrated as it stopped cold. The overloaded carrier, a prisoner of physics, continued forward. The fuel tanks were driven under the logs, shredding and sparking. When they exploded, the load was already airborne, flipping over where the cab, now a green metal accordion, had been. The logs sprayed forward and upward, struck the invisible barrier, and rebounded in all directions. Fire and black smoke boiled upward in a thick plume. There was a terrific thud that rolled across the day like a boulder. Then the logs were raining back down on the Motten side, landing on the road and the surrounding fields like enormous jack straws. One struck the roof of Sea Dog's SUV and smashed it flat, spilling the windshield onto the hood in a spray of diamond crumbles. Another landed right in front of Sea Dogs himself. Barbie stopped running and only stared. Sea Dogs got to his feet, fell down, grasped the log that had almost smashed out his life, and got up again. He stood swaying and wild-eyed. Barbie started toward him, and after 12 steps ran into something that felt like a brick wall. He staggered backward and felt warmth cascade from his nose and over his lips. He wiped away a palm load of blood, looked at it unbelievingly, and then smeared it on his shirt. Now cars were coming from both directions, Motten and Chester's Mill. Three running figures, as yet still small, were cutting across the Graysland from a farmhouse at the other end. Several of the cars were honking their horns, as if that would somehow solve all problems. The first car to arrive on the Motten side pulled over to the shoulder, well back from the burning truck. Two women got out and gawked at the column of smoke and fire, shading their eyes. 7.
"Fuck," Sea Dog said. He spoke in a small, breathless voice.
He approached Barbie through the field, cutting a prudent east-tending diagonal away from the blazing pyre. The trucker might have been overloaded and moving too fast, Barbie thought, but at least he was getting a Viking funeral.
"Did you see where that one log landed? I was almost killed, squashed like a bug. Do you have a cell phone?"
Barbie had to raise his voice to be heard over the furiously burning pulper.
"In my truck," Sea Dog said. "I'll try for it if you want."
"No, wait," Barbie said. He realized, with sudden relief, that all this could be a dream. The irrational kind, where riding your bicycle underwater or talking of your sex life in some language you never studied seems normal. The first person to arrive on his side of the barrier was a chubby guy driving an old GMC pickup. Barbie recognized him from Sweetbriar Rose. Ernie Calvert, the previous manager of Food City, now retired. Ernie was staring at the burning clutter on the road with wide eyes, but he had his cell phone in his hand and was ratchet-jawing into it. Barbie could hardly hear him over the roar of the burning pulp truck, but he made out, "Looks like a bad one," and figured Ernie was talking to the police. or the fire department. If it was the FD, Barbie hoped it was the one in Castle Rock. There were two engines in the tidy little Chester's Mill fire barn, but Barbie had an idea that if they showed up here, the most they'd be able to do was douse a grass fire that was going to putter out on its own before much longer. The burning pulp truck was close, but Barbie didn't think they'd be able to get to it. "It's a dream," he told himself. "If you keep telling yourself that, you'll be able to operate." The two women on the Motten side had been joined by half a dozen men, also shading their eyes. Cars were now parked on both shoulders. More people were getting out and joining the crowd. The same thing was happening on Barbie's side. It was as if a couple of dueling flea markets, both full of juicy bargains, had opened up out here, one on the Motten side of the town line, one on the Chester's Mill side. The trio from the farm arrived, a farmer and his teenage sons. The boys were running easily, the farmer red-faced and panting. "Holy shit," the older boy said, and his father whapped him backside of the head. The boy didn't seem to notice. His eyes were bugging. The younger boy reached out his hand, and when the older boy took it, the younger boy started to cry. "What happened here?" the farmer asked Barbie, pausing to whoop in a big, deep breath between "happened" and "here." Barbie ignored him. He advanced slowly towards Sea Dogs with his right hand held out in a "stop" gesture. Without speaking, Sea Dogs did the same. As Barbie approached the place where he knew the barrier to be, he had only to look at that peculiar straight edge of burnt ground. He slowed down. He had already whammed his face. He didn't want to do it again. Suddenly, he was swept by horripilation. The goosebumps swept up from his ankles all the way to the nape of his neck, where the hair stirred and tried to lift. His balls tingled like tuning forks, and for a moment there was a sour, metallic taste in his mouth. 5 feet away from him, 5 feet in closing, Sea Dog's already wide eyes widened some more.
"Did you feel that?"
"Yes," Barbie said, "but it's gone now. You?"
"Gone,"
Sea Dogs agreed. Their outstretched hands did not quite meet, and Barbie again thought of a pane of glass. Putting your inside hand up against the hand of some outside friend, the fingers together, but not touching. He pulled his hand back. It was the one he'd used to wipe his bloody nose, and he saw the red shapes of his own fingers hanging on thin air. As he watched, the blood began to bead, just as it would on glass.
"Holy God, what does it mean?"
Sea Dogs whispered. Barbie had no answer. Before he could say anything, Ernie Calvert tapped him on the back.
"I called the cops," he said. "They're coming, but no one answers at the fire department. I got a recording telling me to call Castle Rock."
"Okay, do that," Barbie said. Then another bird dropped about 20 feet away, falling into the farmer's grazed land and disappearing. Seeing it brought a new idea into Barbie's mind, possibly sparked by the time he'd spent toting a gun on the other side of the world. "But first I think you better call the Air National Guard up in Bangor." Ernie gaped at him.
"The Guard?"
"They're the only ones who can institute a no-fly zone over Chester's Mill," Barbie said. "And I think they better do it right away." A lot of dead birds. 1. The mill's chief of police heard neither explosion, though he was outside raking leaves on the lawn of his Moran Street home. The portable radio was sitting on the hood of his wife's Honda, playing sacred music on WCIK, call letter standing for Christ is King, and known by the town's younger denizens as Jesus Radio. Also, his hearing wasn't what it once had been. At 67 was anybody's. But he heard the first siren when it cut through the day. His ears were attuned to that sound just as a mother's are to the cries of her children. Howard Perkins even knew which car it was and who was driving. Only 3 and 4 still had the old warblers, but Johnny Trent had taken 3 over to Castle Rock with the FD to that damned training exercise. A controlled burn, they called it. Although what it really amounted to was grown men having fun. So it was car 4, one of their 2 remaining Dodges, and Henry Morrison would be driving. He stopped raking and stood head cocked. The siren started to fade, and he started raking again.
Brenda came out on the stoop. Almost everyone in the mill called him Duke, the nickname a holdover from his high school days when he had never missed a John Wayne picture down at the Star. But Brenda had quit that soon after they were married in favor of the other nickname, the one he disliked.
Howie?
The power's out. And there were bangs. Howie. Always Howie. As in, here's Howie, and Howie's tricks, and Howie's life treating you. They tried to be a Christian about it. Hell, he was a Christian about it, but sometimes he wondered if that nickname wasn't at least partially responsible for the little gadget he now carried around in his chest.
What?
She rolled her eyes, marched to the radio on the hood of her car, and pushed the power button, cutting off the Norman Luboff choir in the middle of What a Friend We Have in Jesus.
How many times have I told you not to stick this thing on the hood of my car? You'll scratch it, and the resale value will go down.
Sorry, Brent, what did you say?
The power's out, and something boomed. That's probably what Johnny Trent's rolling on.
It's Henry, he said. Johnny's over in the Rock with the FD.
Well, whoever it is.
Another siren started up. This one of the newer kind that Duke Perkins thought of as Tweety Birds. That would be two. Jackie Weddington. Had to be Jackie. While Randolph sat minding the store, rocked back in his chair with his feet cocked up on his desk, reading the Democrat, or sitting in the crapper. Peter Randolph was a fair cop, and he could be just as hard as he needed to be, but Duke didn't like him. Partly because he was so clearly Jim Rennie's man. Partly because Randolph was sometimes harder than he needed to be. But mostly because he thought Randolph was lazy, and Duke Perkins could not abide a lazy policeman. Brenda was looking at him with large eyes. She had been a policeman's wife for 43 years, and she knew that two booms, two sirens, and a power failure added up to nothing good. If the lawn got raked this weekend, or if Howie got to listen to his beloved Twin Mills Wildcats take on Castle Rock's football team, she would be surprised.
You better go on in, she said. Something got knocked down. I just hope no one's dead.
He took his cell phone off his belt. Goddamn thing hung there like a leech from morning till night, but he had to admit it was handy. He didn't dial it, just stood looking down at it, waiting for it to ring. But then another Tweety Bird siren went off. Car one. Randolph rolling after all. Which meant something very serious. Duke no longer thought the phone would ring and moved to put it back on his belt. But then it did. It was Stacy Moggin.
Stacy!
He knew he didn't have to bellow into the goddamn thing. Brenda had told him so 100 times, but he couldn't seem to help it.
What are you doing at the station on Saturday morning?
I'm not. I'm at home. Peter called me and said to tell you it's out on 119 and it's bad. He said an airplane and a pulp truck collided.
She sounded dubious.
I don't see how that can be, but...
A plane? Jesus, 5 minutes ago, or maybe a little longer. Well, he'd been raking leaves and singing along with How Great Thou Art.
Stacy, was it Chuck Thompson? I saw that new Piper of his flying over pretty low.
I don't know, Chief. I've told you everything Peter told me.
Brenda, no dummy, was already moving her car so he could back the forest green Chief's car down the driveway. She had set the portable radio beside his small pile of raked leaves.
Okay, Stace. Power out on your side of town, too?
Yes, and the landlines. I'm on my cell. It's probably bad, isn't it?
I hope not. Can you go in and cover? I bet the place is standing there empty and unlocked.
I'll be there in 5. Reach me on the base unit.
Roger that.
As Brenda came back up the driveway, the town whistle went off. Its rise and fall a sound that never failed to make Duke Perkins feel tight in the gut. Nevertheless, he took time to put an arm around Brenda. She never forgot that he took the time to do that.
Don't let it worry you, Brenny. It's programmed to do that in a general power outage. It'll stop in 3 minutes. Or 4. I forget which.
I know, but I still hate it. That idiot Andy Sanders blew it on 9/11. Do you remember? As if they were going to suicide bomb us next.
Duke nodded. Andy Sanders was an idiot.
Unfortunately, he was also first selectman, the cheery Mortimer Snurd dummy that sat on big Jim Rennie's lap.
Honey, I have to go.
I know, but she followed him to the car.
What is it? Do you know yet?
Stacy said a truck and an airplane collided out on 119. Brenda smiled tentatively.
That's a joke, right?
Not if the plane had engine trouble and was trying to land on the highway, Duke said. Her little smile faded and her fisted right hand came to rest just between her breasts. Body language he knew well. He climbed behind the wheel, and although the chief's cruiser was relatively new, he still settled into the shape of his own butt. Duke Perkins was no lightweight.
On your day off, she cried. Really, it's a shame. And when you could retire on a full P...
They'll just have to take me in my Saturday slops, he said, and grinned at her. It was work, that grin. This felt like it was going to be a long day. Just as I am, Lord, just as I am. Stick me a sandwich or two in the fridge, will you?
Just one. You're getting too heavy. Even Dr. Haskell said so, and he never scolds anybody.
One, then. He put the shift in reverse, then put it back in park. He leaned out the window, and she realized he wanted a kiss. She gave him a good one, with the town whistle blowing across the crisp October air, and he caressed the side of her throat while their mouths were together, a thing that always gave her the shivers, and he hardly ever did anymore. His touch there in the sunshine. She never forgot that, either. As he rolled down the driveway, she called something after him. He caught part of it, but not all. He really was going to have to get his ears checked, let them fit him with a hearing aid if necessary, although that would probably be the final thing Randolph and Big Jim needed to kick him out on his aging ass. Duke braked and leaned out again.
Take care of my what?
Your pacemaker, she practically screamed.
Laughing, exasperated, still feeling his hand on her throat, stroking skin that had been smooth and firm, so it seemed to her, only yesterday. Or maybe it had been the day before, when they had listened to Casey and the Sunshine Band instead of Jesus Radio.
Oh, you bet,
he called back, and drove away. The next time she saw him, he was dead. 2. Billy and Wanda DeBeck never heard the double boom, because they were on Route 117 and because they were arguing. The fight had started simply enough, with Wanda observing it was a beautiful day, and Billy responding he had a headache and didn't know why they had to go to the Saturday flea market in Oxford Hills anyway. It would just be the usual pawed-over crap. Wanda said that he wouldn't have a headache if he hadn't sunk a dozen beers the night before. Billy asked her if she had counted the cans in the recycling bin. No matter how loaded he got, Billy did his drinking at home and always put the cans in the recycling bin. These things, along with his work as an electrician, were his pride. She said, yes, she had. You bet she had, furthermore. They got as far as Patel's Market in Castle Rock, having progressed through, you drink too much, Billy, and you nag too much, Wanda, to, my mother told me not to marry you, and why do you have to be such a bitch? This had become a fairly well-worn call and response during the last 2 years of their 4-year marriage, but this morning Billy suddenly felt he had reached his limit. He swung into the market's wide, hot-top parking lot without signaling or slowing, and then back out onto 117 without a single glance into his rearview mirror, let alone over his shoulder. On the road behind him, Nora Robichaud honked. Her best friend Elsa Andrews tutted. The two women, both retired nurses, exchanged a glance, but not a single word. They had been friends too long for words to be necessary in such situations. Meanwhile, Wanda asked Billy where he thought he was going. Billy said back home to take a nap. She could go to the shit fair on her own. Wanda observed that he had almost hit those two old ladies. Said old ladies, now dropping behind fast. Nora Robichaud felt that, lacking some damn good reason, speeds over 40 miles an hour were the devil's work. Billy observed that Wanda both looked and sounded like her mother. Wanda asked him to elucidate just what he meant by that. Billy said that both mother and daughter had fat asses and tongues that were hung in the middle and ran on both ends. Wanda told Billy he was hungover. Billy told Wanda she was ugly. It was a full and fair exchange of feelings, and by the time they crossed from Castle Rock into Motton, headed for an invisible barrier that had come into being not long after Wanda had opened this spirited discussion by saying it was a beautiful day, Billy was doing better than 60, which was almost top-end for Wanda's little Chevy shitbox.
"What's that smoke?"
Wanda asked suddenly, pointing northeast toward 119.
"I don't know," he said. "Did my mother-in-law fart?"
This cracked him up, and he started laughing. Wanda DeBeck realized she had finally had enough. This clarified the world and her future in a way that was almost magical. She was turning to him, the words, "I want a divorce," on the tip of her tongue when they reached the Motton-Chester's Mill town line and struck the barrier. The Chevy shitbox was equipped with airbags, but Billy's did not deploy, and Wanda's didn't pop out completely. The steering wheel collapsed Billy's chest, the steering column smashed his heart. He died almost instantly. Wanda's head collided with the dashboard, and the sudden catastrophic relocation of the Chevy's engine block broke one of her legs, the left, and one of her arms, the right. She was not aware of any pain, only that the horn was blaring, the car was suddenly askew in the middle of the road with its front end smashed almost flat, and her vision had come over all red. When Nora Robichaud and Elsa Andrews rounded the bend just to the south, they had been animatedly discussing the smoke rising to the northeast for several minutes now, and congratulating themselves on having taken the lesser-traveled highway this forenoon. Wanda DeBeck was dragging herself up the white line on her elbows. Blood gushed down her face, almost obscuring it. She had been half-scalped by a piece of the collapsing windshield, and a huge flap of skin hung down over her left cheek like a misplaced jowl. Nora and Elsa looked at each other grimly.
"Shit my pajamas," Nora said,
and that was all the talk between them there was. Elsa got out the instant the car stopped and ran to the staggering woman. For an elderly lady, Elsa had just turned 70. She was remarkably fleet. Nora left the car idling in park and joined her friend. Together they supported Wanda to Norma's old but perfectly maintained Mercedes. Wanda's jacket had gone from brown to a muddy roan color. Her hands looked as if she had dipped them in red paint.
"Where's Billy?"
she asked, and Nora saw that most of the poor woman's teeth had been knocked out. Three of them were stuck to the front of her bloody jacket.
"Where's Billy? Here, eh? What happened?"
"Billy's fine, and so are you," Nora said,
then looked a question at Elsa. Elsa nodded and hurried toward the Chevy, now partly obscured by the steam escaping its ruptured radiator. One look through the gaping passenger door, which hung on one hinge, was enough to tell Elsa, who had been a nurse for almost 40 years. Final employer, Ron Haskell, M.D., the M.D. standing for Medical Doofus, that Billy was not fine at all. The young woman with half her hair hanging upside down beside her head was now a widow. Elsa returned to the Mercedes and got into the back seat next to the young woman, who had slipped into semi-consciousness.
"He's dead, and she will be too if you don't get us to Kathy Russell. Hurry up, chop, chop," she told Nora. "Hang on, then," Nora said, and floored it. Their Mercedes had a big engine, and it leaped forward.
Nora swerved smartly around the DeBeck Chevrolet and crashed into the invisible barrier while still accelerating. For the first time in 20 years, Nora had neglected to fasten her seatbelt, and she went out through the windshield, where she broke her neck on the invisible barrier just as Bob Rue had. The young woman shot between the Mercedes's front bucket seats, out through the shattered windshield, and landed face down on the hood with her blood-spattered legs splayed. Her feet were bare. Her loafers, bought at the last Oxford Hills flea market she had attended, had come off in the first crash. Elsa Andrews hit the back of the driver's seat, then rebounded, dazed but essentially unhurt. Her door stuck at first, but popped open when she put her shoulder against it and rammed. She got out and looked around at the littered wreckage, the puddles of blood, the smashed-up Chevy shitbox still gently steaming.
"What happened?" she asked.
This had also been Wanda's question, although Elsa didn't remember that. She stood in a strew of chrome and bloody glass, then put the back of her left hand to her forehead as if checking for a fever.
What happened? What just happened, Nora? Nora Pye, where are you, dear?
Then she saw her friend and uttered a scream of grief and horror. A crow, watching from high in a pine tree on the mill side of the barrier, cawed once. A cry that sounded like a contemptuous snort of laughter. Elsa's legs turned rubbery. She backed until her bottom struck the crumpled nose of the Mercedes.
Nora Pye, she said. Oh, honey.
Something tickled the back of her neck. She wasn't sure, but thought it was probably a lock of the wounded girl's hair. Only now, of course, she was the dead girl. And poor sweet Nora, with whom she'd sometimes shared illicit nips of gin or vodka in the laundry room at Kathy Russell, the two of them giggling like girls away at camp. Nora's eyes were open, staring up at the bright midday sun, and her head was cocked at a nasty angle, as if she'd died trying to look back over her shoulder and make sure Elsa was all right. Elsa, who was all right, just shaken up, as they'd said of certain lucky survivors back in their ER days, began to cry. She slid down the side of the car, ripping her own coat on a jag of metal, and sat on the asphalt of 117. She was still sitting there and still crying when Barbie and his new friend in the Sea Dog's cap came upon her. 3.
Sea Dogs turned out to be Paul Gendron, a car salesman from upstate who had retired to his late parents' farm in Motton 2 years before. Barbie learned this and a great deal more about Gendron between their departure from the crash scene on 119 and their discovery of another one, not quite so spectacular but still pretty horrific, at the place where Route 117 crossed into the mill. Barbie would have been more than willing to shake Gendron's hand, but such niceties would have to remain on hold until they found the place where the invisible barrier ended.
Ernie Calvert had gotten through to the Air National Guard in Bangor, but had been put on hold before he had a chance to say why he was calling. Meanwhile, approaching sirens heralded the imminent arrival of the local law.
"Just don't expect the fire department," said the farmer who'd come running across the field with his sons. His name was Alden Dinsmore, and he was still getting his breath back. "They're over to Castle Rock, burning down a house for practice. Could have gotten plenty of practice, right?"
Then he saw his younger son approaching the place where Barbie's bloody handprint appeared to be drying on nothing more than sunny air.
"Rory, get away from there!"
Rory, agog with curiosity, ignored him. He reached out and knocked on the air just to the right of Barbie's handprint. But before he did, Barbie saw goosebumps rash out on the kid's arms below the ragged sleeves of his cut-off Wildcat sweatshirt. There was something there, something that kicked in when you got close. The only place Barbie had ever gotten a similar sensation was close to the big power generator in Avon, Florida, where he'd once taken a girl necking. The sound of the kid's fist was like knuckles on the side of a Pyrex casserole dish. It silenced the little babbling crowd of spectators, who had been staring at the burning remains of the pulp truck, and in some cases taking pictures of it with their cell phones.
"I'll be dipped in shit," someone said.
Alden Dinsmore dragged his son away by the ragged collar of his sweatshirt, then whapped him backside of the head as he had the older brother not long before.
"Don't you ever,"
Dinsmore cried, shaking the boy,
"don't you ever, when you don't know what it is.
Pa, it's like a glass wall. It's—"
Dinsmore shook him some more. He was still panting, and Barbie feared for his heart.
"Don't you ever,"
he repeated, and pushed the kid at his older brother.
"Hang on to this fool, Ollie."
"Yes, sir," Ollie said, and smirked at his brother. Barbie looked toward the mill. He could now see the approaching flashers of a police car, but far ahead of it, as if escorting the cops by virtue of some higher authority, was a large black vehicle that looked like a rolling coffin. Big Jim Rennie's Hummer. Barbie's fading bumps and bruises from the fight in Dipper's parking lot seemed to give a sympathetic throb at the sight. Rennie Sr. hadn't been there, of course, but his son had been the prime instigator, and Big Jim had taken care of Junior. If that meant making life in the mill tough for a certain itinerant short-order cook, tough enough so that the short order cook in question would decide to just haul steaks and leave town? Even better. Barbie didn't want to be here when Big Jim arrived, especially not with the cops. Chief Perkins had treated him okay, but the other one, Randolph, had looked at him as if Dale Barbara were a piece of dog shit on a dress shoe. Barbie turned to Sea Dogs and said, "You interested in taking a little hike? You on your side, me on mine, see how far this thing goes."
"And get away from here before yonder gas bag arrives?"
Gendron had also seen the oncoming Hummer.
"My friend, you're on, east or west."
4. They went west, toward Route 117, and they didn't find the end of the barrier. But they saw the wonders it had created when it came down. Tree branches had been sheared off, creating pathways to the sky where previously there had been none. Stumps had been cut in half, and there were feathered corpses everywhere.
"A lot of dead birds,"
Gendron said.
He resettled his cap on his head with hands that trembled slightly. His face was pale.
"Never seen so many."
"Are you all right?" Barbie asked.
"Physically, yeah, I think so. Mentally, I feel like I've lost my frickin' mind. How about you?"
"Same," Barbie said. 2 miles west of 119, they came to God Creek Road and the body of Bob Rue, lying beside his still-idling tractor. Barbie moved instinctively toward the downed man and once again bumped the barrier, although this time he remembered at the last second and slowed in time to keep from bloodying his nose again.
Gendron knelt and touched the farmer's grotesquely cocked neck.
"Dead."
"What's that littered all around him, those white scraps?"
Gendron picked up the largest piece.
"I think it's one of those computer music doohickeys. Must have broke when he hit the..." He gestured in front of him. "The, you know."
From the direction of town, a whooping began, hoarser and louder than the town whistle had been.
Gendron glanced toward it briefly.
"Fire siren," he said. "Much good it'll do."
"FD's coming from Castle Rock," Barbie said. "I hear them."
"Yeah, your ears are better than mine, then. Tell me your name again, friend."
"Dale Barbara, Barbie to my friends."
"Well, Barbie, what now?" "Go on, I guess.
We can't do anything for this guy."
"Nope. Can't even call anyone,"
Gendron said gloomily.
"Not with my cell back there. I guess you don't have one."
Barbie did, but he had left it behind in his now vacated apartment, along with some socks, shirts, jeans, and underwear. He'd lit out for the territory with nothing but the clothes on his back because there was nothing from Chester's Mill he wanted to carry with him, except a few good memories, and for those he didn't need a suitcase or even a knapsack. All this was too complicated to explain to a stranger, so he just shook his head. There was an old blanket draped over the seat of the deer.
Gendron shut the tractor off, took the blanket, and covered the body.
"I hope he was listening to something he liked when it happened,"
Gendron said.
"Yeah," Barbie said.
"Come on, let's get to the end of this, whatever it is. I want to shake your hand. Might even break down and give you a hug."
5. Shortly after discovering Rue's body, they were now very close to the wreck on 117, although neither of them knew it. They came to a little stream. The two men stood there for a moment, each on his own side of the barrier, looking in wonder and silence.
At last, Gendron said,
"Holy jumped up God!"
"What does it look like from your side?" Barbie asked. All he could see on his was the water rising and spreading into the undergrowth. It was as if the stream had encountered an invisible dam.
"I don't know how to describe it. I've never seen anything quite like it."
Gendron paused, scratching both cheeks, drawing his already long face down so he looked a little like the screamer in that Edvard Munch painting.
"Yes, I have. Once, sorta, when I brought home a couple of goldfish for my daughter's 6th birthday. Or maybe she was 7 that year. I brought them home from the pet store in a plastic bag, and that's what this looks like. Water in the bottom of a plastic bag, only flat instead of sagging down. The water piles up against that thing, then trickles off both ways on your side."
Is none going through at all? Gendron bent down, his hands on his knees, and squinted.
Yeah, some appears to go through, but not very much, just a trickle. And none of the crap the water's carrying, you know, sticks and leaves and such.
They pushed on, Gendron on his side and Barbie on his.
As yet, neither of them were thinking in terms of inside and outside. It didn't occur to them that the barrier might not have an end. 6. Then they came to Route 117, where there had been another nasty accident. 2 cars, and at least 2 fatals that Barbie could be sure of. There was another, he thought, slumped behind the wheel of an old Chevrolet that had been mostly demolished. Only this time there was also a survivor, sitting beside a smashed-up Mercedes-Benz with her head lowered.
Paul Gendron rushed to her, while Barbie could only stand and watch. The woman saw Gendron and struggled to rise.
No, ma'am, not at all. You don't want to do that, he said.
I think I'm fine, she said. Just, you know, shaken up.
For some reason this made her laugh, although her face was puffy with tears.
At that moment, another car appeared, a slowpoke, driven by an old fellow who was leading a parade of 3 or 4 other no doubt impatient drivers. He saw the accident and stopped. The cars behind him did too.
Elsa Andrews was on her feet now, and with it enough to ask what would become the question of the day.
What did we hit? It wasn't the other car. Nora went around the other car.
Gendron answered with complete honesty.
Dunno, ma'am.
Ask her if she has a cell phone, Barbie said. Then he called to the gathering spectators. Hey, who's got a cell phone?
I do, mister,
a woman said, but before she could say more, they all heard an approaching whoop, whoop, whoop sound.
It was a helicopter.
Barbie and Gendron exchanged a stricken glance.
The copter was blue and white, flying low. It was angling toward the pillar of smoke marking the crashed pulp truck on 119, but the air was perfectly clear, with that almost magnifying effect that the best days in northern New England seemed to have, and Barbie could easily read the big blue 13 on its side and see the CBSI logo. It was a news chopper out of Portland. It must already have been in the area, Barbie thought, and it was a perfect day to get some juicy crash footage for the 6 o'clock news.
Oh, no!
Gendron moaned, shading his eyes.
Then he shouted, Get back, you fools! Get back! Barbie chimed in.
No! Stop it! Get away!
It was useless, of course. Even more useless, he was waving his arms in big go-away gestures.
Elsa looked from Gendron to Barbie, bewildered.
The chopper dipped to treetop level and hovered. I think it's going to be okay.
Gendron breathed.
The people back there must have been waving him off, too. Pilot must have seen. But then the chopper swung north, meaning to hook in over Alden Dinsmore's grazeland for a different view, and it struck the barrier. Barbie saw one of the rotors break off. The helicopter dipped, dropped, and swerved, all at the same time. Then it exploded, showering fresh fire down on the road and fields on the other side of the barrier.
Gendron sighed.
The outside. 7. Junior Rennie crept like a thief into the house where he had grown up. Or a ghost. It was empty, of course. His father would be out at his giant used car lot on Route 119, what Junior's friend Frank sometimes called the holy tabernacle of no money down. And for the last 4 years, Francine Rennie had been hanging out nonstop at Pleasant Ridge Cemetery. The town whistle had quit and the police sirens had faded off to the south somewhere. The house was blessedly quiet. He took 2 Imitrex, then dropped his clothes and got into the shower. When he emerged, he saw there was blood on his shirt and pants. He couldn't deal with it now. He kicked the clothes under his bed, drew the shades, crawled into the rack, and drew the covers up over his head, as he had when he was a child afraid of closet monsters. He lay there shivering, his head gonging like all the bells of hell. He was dozing when the fire siren went off, jolting him awake. He began to shiver again, but the headache was better. He'd sleep a little, then think about what to do next. Killing himself still seemed by far the best option.
because they'd catch him. He couldn't even go back and clean up. He wouldn't have time before Henry or LaDonna McCain came back from their Saturday errands. He could run, maybe, but not until his head stopped aching. And, of course, he'd have to put some clothes on. He couldn't begin life as a fugitive, bucky-tailed naked. On the whole, killing himself would probably be best. Except then the fucking short-order cook would win. And when you really considered the matter, all this was the fucking cook's fault. At some point, the fire whistle quit. Junior slept with the covers over his head. When he woke up, it was 9 p.m. His headache was gone, and the house was still empty. Cluster Mug 1. When Big Jim Rennie scrunched to a stop in his H3 Alpha Hummer, color black pearl, accessories, you name it, he was a full 3 minutes ahead of the town cops, which was just the way he liked it. Keep ahead of the competition, that was Rennie's motto. Ernie Calvert was still on the phone, but he raised a hand in a half-assed salute. His hair was in disarray, and he looked nearly insane with excitement.
Yo, Big Jim, I got through to him.
Through to who? Rennie asked, not paying much attention. He was looking at the still-burning pyre of the pulp truck, and at the wreckage of what was clearly a plane.
This was a mess. One that could mean a black eye for the town, especially with the two newest fire wagons over in the Rock.
A training exercise he had approved of, but Andy Sanders' signature was the one on the approval form because Andy was first selectman. That was good. Rennie was a great believer in what he called the protectability quotient, and being second selectman was a prime example of the quotient in action. You got all of the power, at least when the first was a nit like Sanders, but rarely had to take the blame when things went wrong. And this was what Rennie, who had given his heart to Jesus at age 16 and did not use foul language, called a cluster mug. Steps would have to be taken. Control would have to be imposed. And he couldn't count on that elderly ass Howard Perkins to do the job. Perkins might have been a perfectly adequate police chief 20 years ago, but this was a new century. Rennie's frown deepened as he surveyed the scene. Too many spectators. Of course, there were always too many at things such as this. People love blood and destruction, and some of these appeared to be playing a bizarre sort of game, seeing how far they could lean over or something.
Bizarre.
You people get back from there, he shouted. He had a good voice for giving orders, big and confident. That's an accident site. Ernie Calvert, another idiot. The town was full of them. Rennie supposed any town was. Tugged at his sleeve. He looked more excited than ever.
Got through to the ANG, Big Jim, and the who, the what are you talking about?
The Air National Guard.
Worse and worse. People playing games, and this fool calling the... Ernie, why would you call them, for gosh sakes?
Because, he said, the guy said. But Ernie couldn't remember exactly what Barbie had said, so he moved on. Well, anyway, the colonel at the ANG listened to what I was telling him, then connected me with Homeland Security in their Portland office, put me right through. Rennie slapped his hands to his cheeks, a thing he did often when he was exasperated. It made him look like a cold-eyed Jack Benny. Like Benny, Big Jim did indeed tell jokes from time to time, always clean ones. He joked because he sold cars, and because he knew politicians were supposed to joke, especially when election time came around. So he kept a small rotating stock of what he called funnies, as in, do you boys want to hear funny? He memorized these much as a tourist in a foreign land will pick up the phrases for stuff like, where is the bathroom? Or, is there a hotel with internet in this village? But he didn't joke now.
Homeland Security? What in the cotton-picking devil for?
Cotton-picking was by far Rennie's favorite epithet.
Because the young guy said there's something across the road. And there is, Jim. Something you can't see. People can lean on it. See, they're doing it now. Or if you throw a stone against it, it bounces back. Look. Ernie picked up a stone and threw it. Rennie did not trouble looking to see where it went. He reckoned if it had struck one of the rubberneckers, the fellow would have given a yell. The truck crashed into it, into the whatever it is, and the plane did, too, and so the guy told me to slow down. What guy exactly are we talking about?
He's a young guy, Rory Dinsmore said. He cooks at Sweetbriar Rose. If you ask for a hamburg medium, that's how you get it. My dad says you can hardly ever get medium because nobody knows how to cook it, but this guy does.
His face broke into a smile of extraordinary sweetness.
I know his name.
Shut up, Roar,
his brother warned. Mr. Rennie's face had darkened. In Ollie Dinsmore's experience, this was the way teachers looked just before they slapped you with a week's worth of detention. Rory, however, paid no mind.
It's a girl's name. It's Barbara.
Just when I think I've seen the last of him, that cotton picker pops up again,
Rennie thought.
That darned useless no-count.
He turned to Ernie Calvert. The police were almost here, but Rennie thought he had time to put a stop to this latest bit of Barbara-induced lunacy. Not that Rennie saw him around. Nor expected to, not really. How like Barbara to stir up the stew, make a mess, then flee.
Ernie, he said, you've been misinformed.
Alden Dinsmore stepped forward.
Mr. Rennie, I don't see how you can say that when you don't know what the information is.
Rennie smiled at him, pulled his lips back anyway.
I know Dale Barbara, Alden. I have that much information.
He turned back to Ernie Calvert.
Now, if you'll just...
Hush,
Calvert said, holding up a hand.
I got someone.
Big Jim Rennie did not like to be hushed, especially by a retired grocery store manager. He plucked the phone from Ernie's hand as though Ernie were an assistant who had been holding it for just that purpose. A voice from the cell phone said,
To whom am I speaking?
Less than half a dozen words, but they were enough to tell Rennie that he was dealing with a bureaucratic son of a buck. The Lord knew he'd dealt with enough of them in his 3 decades as a town official, and the feds were the worst.
This is James Rennie, second selectman at Chester's Mill. Who are you, sir?
Donald Wozniak, Homeland Security. I understand you have some sort of problem out there on Highway 119, an interdiction of some kind.
Interdiction? Interdiction? What kind of fed speak was that?
You have been misinformed, sir, Rennie said. What we have is an airplane, a civilian plane, a local plane that tried to land on the road and hit a truck. The situation is completely under control. We do not require the aid of Homeland Security.
Mr. Rennie, the farmer said,
that is not what happened.
Rennie flapped a hand at him and began walking around the first police cruiser. Hank Morrison was getting out. Big, 6'5 or so, but basically useless. And behind him, the gal with the big old titties. Weddington, her name was. And she was worse than useless, a smart mouth run by a dumb head. But behind her, Peter Randolph was pulling up. Randolph was the assistant chief, and a man after Rennie's own heart, a man who could get her done. If Randolph had been the duty officer on the night Junior got in trouble at that stupid devil pit of a bar, Big Jim doubted if Mr. Dale Barbara would still have been in town to cause trouble today. In fact, Mr. Barbara might have been behind bars, over in the Rock, which would have suited Rennie fine. Meanwhile, the man from Homeland Security, did they have the nerve to call themselves agents, was still jabbering away. Rennie interrupted him.
Thank you for your interest, Mr. Wozniak, but we've got this handled.
He pushed the end button without saying goodbye. Then he tossed the phone back to Ernie Calvert. Jim, I don't think that was wise.
Rennie ignored him and watched Randolph stop behind the Weddington gal's cruiser, bubblegum bars flashing. He thought about walking down to meet Randolph, and rejected the idea before it was fully formed in his mind. Let Randolph come to him. That was how it was supposed to work. And how it would work, by God.
2.
Big Jim, Randolph said. What's happened here?
I believe that's obvious, Big Jim said. Chuck Thompson's airplane got into a little argument with a pulp truck. Looks like they fought it to a draw.
Now he could hear sirens coming from Castle Rock. Almost certainly FD responders. Rennie hoped their own two new and horribly expensive fire wagons were among them. It would play better if no one actually realized the new trucks had been out of town when this cluster mug happened. Ambulances and police would be close behind.
That ain't what happened, Alden Dinsmore said stubbornly. I was out in the side garden, and I saw the plane just...
Better move those people back, don't you think?
Rennie asked Randolph, pointing to the looky-loos.
There were quite a few on the pulp truck side, standing prudently away from the blazing remains, and even more on the mill side. It was starting to look like a convention.
Randolph addressed Morrison and Weddington.
Hank,
he said, and pointed at the spectators from the mill. Some had begun prospecting among the scattered pieces of Thompson's plane. There were cries of horror as more body parts were discovered.
Yo,
Morrison said, and got moving. Randolph turned Weddington toward the spectators on the pulp truck side.
Jackie, you take...
But there Randolph trailed off. The disaster groupies on the south side of the accident were standing in the cow pasture on one side of the road, and knee-deep in scrubby bushes on the other. Their mouths hung open, giving them a look of stupid interest Rennie was very familiar with. He saw it on individual faces every day, and en masse every March, at town meeting. Only these people weren't looking at the burning truck. And now Peter Randolph, certainly no dummy, not brilliant, not by a long shot, but at least he knew which side his bread was buttered on, was looking at the same place as the rest of them, and with that same expression of slack-jawed amazement. So was Jackie Weddington. It was the smoke the rest were looking at. The smoke rising from the burning pulper. It was dark and oily. The people downwind should have been darn near choking on it, especially with a light breeze out of the south, but they weren't. And Rennie saw the reason why. It was hard to believe, but he saw it all right. The smoke did blow north, at least at first, but then it took an elbow bend, almost a right angle, and rose straight up in a plume, as if in a chimney. And it left a dark brown residue behind, a long smudge that just seemed to float on the air. Jim Rennie shook his head to clear the image away, but it was still there when he stopped.
What is it?
Randolph asked. His voice was soft with wonder. Dinsmore, the farmer, placed himself in front of Randolph.
That guy, pointing at Ernie Calvert, had Homeland Security on the phone, and this guy, pointing at Rennie in a theatrical courtroom gesture Rennie didn't care for in the least, took the phone out of his hand and hung up. He shouldn't have done that, Pete, because that was no collision. The plane wasn't anywhere near the ground. I seen it. I was covering plants in case of frost, and I seen it.
I did too,
Rory began, and this time it was his brother Ollie who went up the backside of Rory's head. Rory began to whine. Alden Dinsmore said,
It hit something. Same thing the truck hit. It's there. You can touch it. That young fella, the cook, said there ought to be a no-fly zone out here, and he was right. But Mr. Rennie,
again pointing at Rennie like he thought he was a gosh darn Perry Mason instead of a fellow who earned his daily bread attaching suction cups to cows' titties,
wouldn't even talk. Just hung up.
Rennie did not stoop to rebuttal.
You're wasting time, he told Randolph.
Moving a little closer, and speaking just above a whisper, he added,
The chief's coming. My advice would be to look sharp and control this scene before he gets here.
He cast a cold momentary eye on the farmer.
You can
interview the witnesses later. But maddeningly, it was Alden Dinsmore who got the last word.
That fella, Baba, was right. He was right, and Rennie was wrong.
Rennie marked Alden Dinsmore for later action. Sooner or later, farmers always came to the selectmen with their hats in their hands, wanting an easement, a zoning exception, something. And when Mr. Dinsmore next showed up, he would find little comfort, if Rennie had anything to say about it, and he usually did.
"Control this scene," he told Randolph. "Jackie, move those people back,"
the assistant chief said, pointing toward the looky-loos on the pulp truck side of the accident.
"Establish a perimeter."
"Sir, I think those folks are actually in Motton."
"I don't care. Move them back."
Randolph glanced over his shoulder to where Duke Perkins was working his way out of the green chief's car, a car Randolph longed to see in his own driveway, and would, with Big Jim Rennie's help, in another 3 years at the very latest.
"Castle Rock PD will thank you when they get here, believe me."
"What about..." She pointed at the smoke smudge, which was still spreading. Seen through it, the October colorful trees looked a uniform dark gray, and the sky was an unhealthy shade of yellowy blue.
"Stay clear of it," Randolph said, then went to help Hank Morrison establish the perimeter on the Chester's Mill side.
First, he needed to bring Perk up to speed. Jackie approached the people on the pulp truck side. The crowd over there was growing all the time as the early arrivers worked their cell phones. Some had stamped out little fires in the bushes, which was good, but now they were just standing around gawking. She used the same shooing gestures Hank was employing on the mill side, and chanted the same mantra.
"Get back, folks. It's all over. Nothing to see you haven't seen already. Clear the road for the fire trucks and the police. Get back. Clear the area. Go home. Get back."
She hit something. Rennie had no idea what it was, but he could see the result. The brim of her hat collided with it first. It bent, and the hat tumbled off behind her. An instant later, those insolent titties of hers, a couple of cotton-picking gun shells was what they were, flattened. Then her nose squashed and gave up a jet of blood that splattered against something and began to run down in long drips, like paint on a wall. She went on her well-padded ass with an expression of shock on her face. The god-darn farmer stuck his oar in then. "See what I tell ya?" Randolph and Morrison hadn't seen. Neither had Perkins. The three of them were conferring together by the hood of the chief's car. Rennie briefly considered going to Weddington, but others were doing that, and besides, she was still a little too close to whatever it was she'd run into. He hurried toward the men instead, set face and big, hard belly projecting get-her-done authority. He spared a glare for Farmer Dinsmore on his way by.
"Chief," he said, butting in between Morrison and Randolph.
"Big Jim," Perkins said, nodding. "You didn't waste any time, I see."
This was perhaps a jibe, but Rennie, a sly old fish, did not rise to the bait.
"I'm afraid there's more going on here than meets the eye. I think someone had better get in touch with Homeland Security."
He paused, looking suitably grave.
"I don't want to say there's terrorism involved, but I won't say there isn't."
3. Duke Perkins looked past Big Jim. Jackie was being helped to her feet by Ernie Calvert and Johnny Carver, who ran Mill Gas and Grocery. She was dazed, and her nose was bleeding, but she appeared all right otherwise. Nevertheless, this whole situation was hinky. Of course, any accident where there were fatalities felt that way to some extent, but there was more wrong here. For one thing, the plane hadn't been trying to land. There were too many pieces, and they were too widely scattered for him to believe that. And the spectators? They weren't right either. Randolph hadn't noticed, but Duke Perkins did. They should have formed into one big, spreading clump. It was what they always did, as if for comfort in the face of death. Only these had formed two clumps. And the one on the Motton side of the town line marker was awfully close to the still-burning truck. Not in any danger, he judged. But why didn't they move over here? The first fire truck swept around the curb to the south. Three of them. Duke was glad to see that the second one in line had Chester's Mill Fire Department Pumper Number 2 printed in gold on the side. The crowd shuffled back farther into the scrubby bushes, giving them room. Duke returned his attention to Rennie.
What happened here? Do you know?
Rennie opened his mouth to reply, but before he could, Ernie Calvert spoke up.
There's a barrier across the road. You can't see it, but it's there, Chief. The truck hit it. The plane, too.
Damn right, Dinsmore exclaimed.
Officer Weddington hit it, too, Johnny Carver said. Lucky for her, she was going slower.
He had placed an arm around Jackie, who looked dazed. Duke observed her blood on the sleeve of Carver's I got gassed at Mill Discount jacket. On the mountain side, another FD truck had arrived. The first two had blocked the road in a V. Firemen were already spilling out and unrolling hoses. Duke could hear the warble of an ambulance from the direction of Castle Rock. Where's ours? He wondered. Had it also gone to that stupid damn training exercise? He didn't like to think so. Who in their right mind would order an ambulance to an empty burning house?
There seems to be an invisible barrier, Rennie began.
Yeah, I got that, Duke said. I don't know what it means, but I got it.
He left Rennie and went to his bleeding officer, not seeing the dark red color that suffused the second selectman's cheek at this snub.
Jackie, Duke asked, taking her gently by the shoulder. All right.
Yeah.
She touched her nose where the blood flow was slowing.
Does it look broken? It doesn't feel broken.
It's not broken, but it's going to swell. Think you'll look all right by the time the harvest ball comes around, though.
She offered a weak smile.
Chief, Rennie said, I really think we ought to call someone on this. If not Homeland Security, on more mature reflection, that seems a little radical.
Then perhaps the state police.
Duke moved him aside. It was gentle, but unequivocal. Almost a push. Rennie balled his hands into fists, then unrolled them again. He had built a life in which he was a pusher, rather than a pushy. But that didn't alter the fact that fists were for idiots. Witness his own son. All the same, slights needed to be noted and addressed, usually at some later date. But sometimes, later was better. Sweeter.
Peter, Duke called to Randolph, give the health center a shout and ask where the hell our ambulance is. I want it out here.
Morrison can do that, Randolph said. He had grabbed the camera from his car and was turning to snap pictures of the scene.
You can do it, and right now.
Chief, I don't think Jackie's too banged up, and no one else.
When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it, Peter.
Randolph started to give him a look, then saw the expression on Duke's face. He tossed the camera back onto the front seat of his shop and grabbed his cell phone.
What was it, Jackie?
Duke asked. I don't know. First there was a buzzy feeling like you get if you accidentally touch the prongs of a plug when you're sticking it into the wall. It passed, but then I hit... Jeez. I don't know what I hit. An ah sound went up from the spectators. The firemen had trained their hoses on the burning pulp truck, but beyond it, some of the spray was rebounding, striking something and splattering back, creating rainbows in the air. Duke had never seen anything like it in his life. Except maybe when you were in a car wash, watching the high-pressure jets hit your windshield. Then he saw a rainbow on the mill side as well. A small one. One of the spectators, Lissa Jameson, the town librarian, walked toward it.
Lissa, get away from there, Duke shouted.
She ignored him. It was as if she were hypnotized. She stood inches from where a jet of high-pressure water was striking thin air and splashing back, her hands spread. He could see drops of mist sparkling on her hair, which was pulled away from her face and bunned at the back. The little rainbow broke up, then reformed behind her.
Nothing but mist, she called, sounding rapturous. All that water over there, and nothing but mist over here. Like
from a humidifier.
Peter Randolph held up his cell phone and shook his head. I get a signal, but I'm not getting through. My guess is that all these spectators, he swept his arm in a big arc, have got everything jammed up.
Duke didn't know that were possible, but it was true that almost everyone he could see was either yakking or taking pictures. Except for Lissa, that was, who was still doing her wood nymph imitation.
Go get her, Duke told Randolph. Pull her back before she decides to haul out her crystals or something.
Randolph's face suggested that such errands were far below his pay grade, but he went. Duke uttered a laugh. It was short, but genuine.
What in the goodness sakes do you see that's worth laughing about? Rennie asked.
More Castle County cops were pulling up on the Motton side. If Perkins didn't look out, the Rock would end up taking control of this thing and getting the gosh darn credit. Duke stopped laughing, but he was still smiling, unabashed.
It's a cluster mug, he said.
Isn't that your word, Big Jim? And in my experience, sometimes laughing is the only way to deal with a cluster mug.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Rennie almost shouted.
The Dinsmore boys stepped back from him and stood beside their father.
I know, Duke spoke gently, and that's okay. All you need to understand right now is that I'm the chief law enforcement officer on the scene, at least until the county sheriff gets here, and you're a town selectman. You have no official standing, so I'd like you to move back.
Duke raised his voice and pointed to where Officer Henry Morrison was stringing yellow tape, stepping around two largish pieces of airplane fuselage to do it.
I'd like everyone to move back and let us do our job. Follow Selectman Rennie. He's going to lead you behind the yellow tape.
I don't appreciate this, Duke, Rennie said.
God bless you, but I don't give a shit, Duke said. Get off my scene, Big Jim, and be sure to go around the tape. No need for Henry to have to string it twice.
Chief Perkins, I want you to remember how you spoke to me today. Because I will.
Rennie stalked toward the tape. The other spectators followed, most looking over their shoulders to watch the water spray off the diesel-smudged barrier and form a line of wetness on the road. A couple of the sharper ones, Ernie Calvert, for instance, had already noticed that this line exactly mimicked the border between Motton and the mill. Rennie felt a childish temptation to snap Hank Morrison's carefully strung tape with his chest, but he restrained himself. He would not, however, go around and get his Land's End slacks snagged in a mess of burdocks. They had cost him $60. He shuffled under, holding up the tape with one hand. His belly made serious ducking impossible. Behind him, Duke walked slowly toward the place where Jackie had suffered her collision. He held one hand outstretched before him like a blind man prospecting his way across an unfamiliar room. Here was where she had fallen down. And here. He felt the buzzing she had described, but instead of passing, it deepened to searing pain in the hollow of his left shoulder. He had just enough time to remember the last thing Brenda had said. Take care of your pacemaker. And then it exploded in his chest with enough force to blow open his Wildcat sweatshirt, which he'd donned that morning in honor of this afternoon's game. Blood, scraps of cotton, and bits of flesh struck the barrier. The crowd awed. Duke tried to speak his wife's name and failed, but he saw her face clearly in his mind. She was smiling. Then, darkness. 4. The kid was Benny Drake, 14, and a Razor. The Razors were a small but dedicated skateboarding club, frowned on by the local constabulary, but not actually outlawed, in spite of calls from Selectman Rennie and Sanders for such action. At last March's town meeting, this same dynamic duo had succeeded in tabling a budget item that would have funded a safe skateboarding area on the town common behind the bandstand. The adult was Eric Rusty Everett, 37, a physician's assistant working with Dr. Ron Haskell, whom Rusty often thought of as the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, because, Rusty would have explained, if he'd anyone other than his wife he could trust with such disloyalty, he so often remains behind the curtain while I do the work. Now he checked the state of young Master Drake's last tetanus shot. Fall of 2009, very good. Especially considering that young Master Drake had done a Wilson while cement shooting and torn up his calf pretty good. Not a total Jake, but a lot worse than simple road rash.
Power's back on, dude,
young Master Drake offered.
Generator, dude, Rusty said.
Handles the hospital and the health center. Radical, huh?
Old school,
young Master Drake agreed. For a moment, the adult and the adolescent regarded the 6-inch gash in Benny Drake's calf without speaking. Cleaned of dirt and blood, it looked ragged, but no longer downright awful. The town whistle had quit, but far in the distance, they could hear sirens. Then the fire whistle went off, making them both jump. Ambulance is gonna roll, Rusty thought. Sure as shit. Twitching Everett right again. Better hurry this up. Except the kid's face was pretty white, and Rusty thought there were tears standing in his eyes.
Scared?
Rusty asked.
A little, Benny Drake said. Ma's gonna ground me.
Is that what you're scared of?
Because he guessed that Benny Drake had been grounded a few times before, like, often, dude.
Well, how much is it gonna hurt? Rusty had been hiding the syringe. Now he injected 3 cc's of xylocaine and epinephrine, a deadening compound he still called Novocaine. He took his time infiltrating the wound, so as not to hurt the kid any more than he had to.
About that much?
Whoa, Benny said. Stat, baby. Code blue.
Rusty laughed.
Did you full pipe before you Wilsoned?
As a long-retired boarder, he was honestly curious.
Only half, but it was toxic, Benny said, brightening. How many stitches do you think Nori Calvert took 12 when she ledged out in Oxford last summer?
Not that many, Rusty said. He knew Nori, a mini-goth whose chief aspiration seemed to be killing herself on a skateboard before bearing her first woods colt. He pressed near the wound with the needle end of the syringe.
Feel that? Yeah, dude, totally. Did you hear, like, a bang out there?
Benny pointed vaguely south as he sat on the examining table in his undershorts, bleeding onto the paper cover.
Nope, Rusty said.
He had actually heard 2, not bangs, but, he was afraid, explosions. Had to make this fast.
Where was the wizard?
Doing rounds, according to Ginny, which probably meant snoozing in the Kathy Russell doctor's lounge. It was where the wonderful Wiz did most of his rounds these days.
Feel it now? Rusty poked again with the needle. Don't look, looking is cheating.
No, man, nothing, you're goofing with me.
I'm not, you're numb.
In more ways than one, Rusty thought.
Okay, here we go, lie back, relax, and enjoy flying Kathy Russell Airlines.
He scrubbed the wound with sterile saline, debrided, then trimmed with his trusty number 10 scalpel.
6 stitches with my very best 4-0 nylon.
Awesome, the kid said. Then I think I may hurl.
Rusty handed him an emesis basin, in these circumstances known as a puke pan.
Hurl in this, faint, and you're on your own.
Benny didn't faint. He didn't hurl either. Rusty was placing a sterile gauze sponge on the wound when there was a perfunctory knock at the door, followed by Ginny Tomlinson's head.
Can I speak to you for a minute?
Don't worry about me, Benny said. I'm like freely radical.
Cheeky little bugger.
In the hall, Rusty, Ginny said.
She didn't give the kid a glance.
I'll be right back, Benny. Sit there and relax.
Chillax and no prob.
Rusty followed Ginny out into the hall.
Ambulance time? He asked.
Beyond Ginny, in the sunny waiting room, Benny's mother was looking grimly down at a paperback with a sweet savage cover. Ginny nodded.
119 at the Tarker's town line. There's another accident on the other town line, Martin, but I'm hearing everyone involved in that one is DATS.
Dead at the scene.
Truck-plane collision. The plane was trying to land.
Are you shitting me?
Alva Drake looked around, frowning, then went back to her paperback.
or at least to looking at it while she tried to decide if her husband would support her in grounding Benny until he was 18. "This is an authentic no-shit situation," Ginny said. "I'm getting reports of other crashes, too."
"Weird."
"But the guy out on the Tarker's town line is still alive, rolled a delivery truck, I believe. Buzz, cuz. Twitch is waiting."
"You'll finish the kid?"
"Yes. Go on, go."
"Dr. Rayburn?"
"Had patients in Stevens Memorial."
This was the Norway South Paris Hospital.
"He's on his way. Rusty, go."
He paused on his way out to tell Mrs. Drake that Benny was fine. Alva did not seem overjoyed at the news, but thanked him. Dougie Twitchell, Twitch, was sitting on the bumper of the out-of-date ambulance Jim Rennie and his fellow selectmen kept not replacing, smoking a cigarette and taking some sun. He was holding a portable CB, and it was lively with talk, voices popping like corn and jumping all over each other.
"Put out that cancer stick and let's get rolling," Rusty said. "You know where we're going, right?"
Twitch flipped the butt away. Despite his nickname, he was the calmest nurse Rusty had ever encountered, and that was saying a lot.
"I know what Jinjin told you. Tarker's Chester's town line, right?"
"Yes, overturned truck."
"Yeah, well, plans have changed. We gotta go the other way."
He pointed to the southern horizon where a thick black pillar of smoke was rising.
"Ever had a desire to see a crashed plane?"
"I have," Rusty said. "In the service, two guys, you could have spread what was left on bread. That was plenty for me, Pilgrim. Ginny says they're all dead out there, so why?"
"Maybe so, maybe no," Twitch said. "But now Perkins is down, and he might not be."
"Chief Perkins?"
"The very same. I'm thinking the prognosis ain't good if the pacemaker blew right out of his chest, which is what Peter Randolph is claiming. But he is the chief of police, fearless leader."
"Twitch, buddy, a pacemaker can't blow like that. It's perfectly impossible."
"Then maybe he is still alive, and we can do some good," Twitch said.
Halfway around the hood of the ambo, he took out his cigarettes. "You're not smoking in the ambulance," Rusty said. Twitch looked at him sadly. "Unless you share, that is." Twitch sighed and handed him the pack.
"Ah, Marlboros," Rusty said. "My very favorite OPs."
"You slay me," Twitch said.
5. They blew through the stoplight where Route 117 teed into 119 at the center of town. Siren blaring, both of them smoking like fiends, with the windows open, which was SOP, listening to the chatter from the radio. Rusty understood little of it, but he was clear on one thing. He was going to be working long past 4 o'clock.
"Man, I don't know what happened," Twitch said, "but there's this. We're going to see a genuine aircraft crash site. Post-crash, true, but beggars cannot be choosers."
"Twitch, you're one sick canine." There was a lot of traffic, mostly headed south. A few of these folks might have legitimate errands, but Rusty thought most were human flies being drawn to the smell of blood. Twitch passed a line of 4 with no problem. The northbound lane of 119 was oddly empty.
"Look," Twitch said, pointing. "News chopper. We're going to be on the 6 o'clock news, Big Rusty. Heroic paramedics fight to..."
But that was where Dougie Twitchell's flight of fancy ended. Ahead of them, at the accident site, Rusty presumed, the helicopter did a button hook. For a moment he could read the number 13 on its side and see the CBSI. Then it exploded, raining down fire from the cloudless early afternoon sky. Twitch cried out,
"Jesus, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it."
And then childishly, hurting Rusty's heart even in his shock,
"I take it back."
6.
"Now I gotta go back," Gendron said.
He took off his sea dog's cap and wiped his bloody, grimy, pallid face with it. His nose had swollen until it looked like a giant's thumb. His eyes peered out of dark circles.
"I'm sorry, but my schnoz is hurting like hell, and, well, I ain't as young as I used to be. Also..."
He raised his arms and dropped them. They were facing each other,
and Barbie would have taken the guy in his arms and given him a pat on the back if it were possible. Shock to the system, isn't it?
He asked Gendron. Gendron gave a bark of laughter.
That copter was the final touch. And they both looked toward the fresh column of smoke.
Barbie and Gendron had gone on from the accident site on 117 after making sure that the witnesses were getting help for Elsa Andrews, the sole survivor.
At least she didn't seem badly hurt, although she was clearly heartbroken over the loss of her friend. Going back then, slow. Take your time. Rest when you need to.
Pushing on?
Yes.
Still think you're going to find the end of it?
Barbie was silent for a moment. At first, he'd been sure, but now... I hope so, he said.
Well, good luck.
Gendron tipped his cap to Barbie before putting it back on.
I hope to shake your hand before the day's out.
Me too, Barbie said. He paused. He had been thinking. Can you do something for me if you can get to your cell phone?
Sure.
Call the Army base at Fort Benning. Ask for the liaison officer and tell them you need to get in touch with Colonel James O. Cox. Tell them it's urgent, that you're calling for Captain Dale Barbara. Can you remember that?
Dale Barbara, that's you. James Cox, that's him.
Got it. If you reach him, I'm not sure you will, but if, tell him what's going on here. Tell him if no one's gotten in touch with Homeland Security, he's the man. Can you do that?
Gendron nodded.
If I can, I will. Good luck, soldier.
Barbie could have done without ever having been called that again, but he touched a finger to his forehead. Then he went on, looking for what he no longer thought he would find. 7. He found a woods road that roughly paralleled the barrier. It was overgrown and disused, but much better than pushing through the pucker brush. Every now and then he diverted to the west, feeling for the wall between Chester's Mill and the outside world. He was always there. When Barbie came to where 119 crossed into the mill's sister town of Tarker's Mills, he stopped. The driver of the overturned delivery truck had been taken away by some Good Samaritan on the other side of the barrier, but the truck itself lay blocking the road like a big dead animal. The back doors had sprung open on impact. The tar was littered with devil dogs, ho-hos, ring-dings, Twinkies, and peanut butter crackers. A young man in a George Strait t-shirt sat on a stump, eating one of the latter. He had a cell phone in hand. He looked up at Barbie.
Yo, did you come from...
He pointed vaguely behind Barbie. He looked tired and scared and disillusioned. From the other side of town, Barbie said. Right.
Invisible wall the whole way. Border closed.
Yes. The young man nodded and hit a button on his cell.
Dusty, you there yet?
He listened some more, then said,
okay.
He ended the call.
My friend Dusty and I started east of here. Split up. He went south. We've been staying in touch by phone. When we can get through, that is. He's where the copter crashed now. Says it's getting crowded there.
Barbie bet it was.
No break in this thing anywhere on your side?
The young man shook his head. He didn't say more. And didn't need to. They could have missed breaks. Barbie knew that was possible. Holes the size of windows or doors. But he doubted it. He thought they were cut off. We all support the team. 1. Barbie walked back down Route 119 into the center of town, a distance of about 3 miles. By the time he got there, it was 6 o'clock. Main Street was almost deserted, but alive with the roar of generators, dozens of them by the sound. The traffic light at the intersection of 119 and 117 was dark, but Sweetbriar Rose was lit and loaded. Looking through the big front window, Barbie saw that every table was taken. But when he walked in the door, he heard none of the usual big talk. Politics, the Red Sox, the local economy, the Patriots, newly acquired cars and pick-em-ups, the Celtics, the price of gas, the Bruins, newly acquired power tools, the Twin Mills Wildcats, none of the usual laughter, either. There was a TV over the counter, and everyone was watching it.
Barbie observed, with that sense of disbelief and dislocation everyone who actually finds him or herself at the site of a major disaster must feel, that CNN's Anderson Cooper was standing out on Route 119 with the still-smoldering hulk of the wrecked pulp truck in the background. Rose herself was waiting table, occasionally darting back to the counter to take an order. Wispy locks of hair were escaping her net and hanging around her face. She looked tired and harried. The counter was supposed to be Angie McCain's territory from 4 until closing, but Barbie saw no sign of her tonight. Perhaps she'd been out of town when the barrier slammed down. If that were the case, she might not be back behind the counter for a good long while. Anson Wheeler, whom Rosie usually just called the kid, although the guy had to be at least 25, was cooking, and Barbie dreaded to think what Ants might do to anything more complicated than Beans and Franks, the traditional Saturday night special at Sweetbriar Rose. Woe to the fellow or gal who ordered breakfast for dinner and had to face Anson's nuclear fried eggs. Still, it was good he was here, because in addition to the missing Angie, there was also no sign of Dodie Sanders, although that particular drip didn't need a disaster to keep her away from work. She wasn't lazy, exactly, but she was easily distracted, and when it came to brain power, geez, what could you say? Her father, Andy Sanders, the mill's first selectman, would never be a Mensa candidate, but Dodie made him look like Albert Einstein. On the TV, helicopters were landing behind Anderson Cooper, blowing his groovy white hair around and nearly drowning his voice. The copters looked like Pavlos. Barbie had ridden in his share during his time in Iraq. Now an army officer walked into the picture, covered Cooper's mic with one gloved hand, and spoke in the reporter's ear. The assembled diners in Sweetbriar Rose murmured among themselves. Barbie understood their disquiet. He felt it himself. When a man in a uniform covered a famous TV reporter's mic without so much as a by your leave, it was surely the end of days. The army guy, a colonel, but not his colonel, seeing Cox would have completed Barbie's sense of mental dislocation, finished what he had to say. His glove made a windy whoop sound when he took it off the mic. He walked out of the shot, his face a stolid blank. Barbie recognized the look. Army pod person. Cooper was saying, "The press is being told we have to fall back half a mile to a place called Raymond's Roadside Store." The patrons murmured again at this. They all knew Raymond's Roadside in Motton, where the sign in the window said, "Cold beer, hot sandwiches, fresh bait." This area, less than 100 yards from what we're calling the barrier, for want of a better term, has been declared a national security site. We'll resume our coverage as soon as we can. But right now, I'm sending it back to you in Washington, Wolf. The headline on the red band beneath the location shot read, "Breaking news, main town, cut off, mystery deepens." And in the upper right-hand corner, in red, the word "severe" was blinking, like a neon tavern sign. Drink severe beer, Barbie thought, and nearly chuckled. Wolf Blitzer took Anderson Cooper's place. Rose had a crush on Blitzer, and would not allow the TV to be tuned to anything but the Situation Room on weekday afternoons. She called him "My Wolfie." This evening, Wolfie was wearing a tie, but it was badly knotted, and Barbie thought the rest of his clothes looked suspiciously like Saturday grubs.
"Recapping our story," Rose's Wolfie said. "This afternoon at roughly 1 o'clock. "'Twas earlier than that and by quite a patch," someone said.
"Is it true about Myra Evans?" someone else asked. "Is she really dead?"
"Yes," Fernald Bowie said.
The town's only undertaker, Stuart Bowie, was Fern's older brother. Fern sometimes helped him out when he was sober, and he looked sober tonight. Shocked sober.
"Now shut your quack so I can hear this."
Barbie wanted to hear it, too, because Wolfie was even now addressing the question Barbie cared most about, and saying what Barbie wanted to hear, that the airspace over Chester's Mill had been declared a no-fly zone. In fact, all of western Maine and eastern New Hampshire, from Lewiston, Auburn, to North Conway, was a no-fly zone. The president was being briefed, and for the first time in 9 years, the color of the National Threat Advisory had exceeded orange. Julia Shumway, owner and editor of The Democrat, shot Barbie a glance as he passed her table.
Then the pinched and secretive little smile that was her specialty, almost her trademark, flickered on her face. It seems that Chester's Mill doesn't want to let you go, Mr. Barbara.
So it seems, Barbie agreed.
That she knew he had been leaving, and why, didn't surprise him. He spent enough time in the mill to know Julia Shumway knew everything worth knowing. Rose saw him as she was serving beans and franks, plus a smoking relic that might once have been a pork chop, to a party of six crammed around a table for four. She froze with a plate in each hand and two more on her arm, eyes wide. Then she smiled. It was one full of undisguised happiness and relief, and it lifted his heart. This is what home feels like, he thought. God damned if it isn't.
Good gravy, I never expected to see you again, Dale Barbara.
You still got my apron? Barbie asked, a little shyly. Rose had taken him in, after all, just a drifter with a few scribbled references in his backpack and given him work. She told him she completely understood why he felt he had to blow town. Junior Rennie's dad wasn't a fellow you wanted for an enemy, but Barbie still felt as if he'd left her in the lurch. Rose put down her load of plates anywhere there was room for them and hurried to Barbie. She was a plump little woman, and she had to stand on tiptoe to hug him, but she managed.
I am so goddamn glad to see you, she whispered.
Barbie hugged her back and kissed the top of her head. Big Jim and Junior won't be, he said. But at least neither Rennie was here. There was that to be grateful for. Barbie was aware that, for the time being at least, he had become even more interesting to the assembled Millites than their very own town on national TV.
Big Jim Rennie can blow me, she said.
Barbie laughed, delighted by her fierceness, but glad for her discretion. She was still whispering.
I thought you were gone.
I almost was, but I got a late start.
Did you see it?
Yes. Tell you later. He released her, held her at arm's length, and thought, if you were 10 years younger, Rose, or even 5. So I can have my apron back? She wiped the corners of her eyes and nodded.
Please, take it back. Get Anson out of there before he kills us all.
Barbie gave her a salute, then hooked around the corner into the kitchen and sent Anson Wheeler to the counter, telling him to take care of orders and clean up there before helping Rose in the main room. Anson stepped back from the grill with a sigh of relief. Before going to the counter, he shook Barbie's right hand in both of his.
Thank God, man. I never seen such a rush. I was lost.
Don't worry. We're going to feed the 5,000. Anson, no biblical scholar, looked blank.
Huh?
Never mind. The bell sitting in the corner of the pass-through binged.
Order up, Rose called.
Barbie grabbed a spatula before taking the slip. The grill was a mess, it always was, when Anson was engaged in those cataclysmic heat-induced changes he called cooking. Then slipped his apron over his head, tied it in back, and checked the cabinet over the sink. It was full of baseball caps, which served Sweetbriar Rose grill monkeys as chef's toques. He selected a sea dog's cap in honor of Paul Gendron, now in the bosom of his nearest and dearest, Barbie hoped, yanked it on backward, and cracked his knuckles. Then he grabbed the first slip and went to work. 2. By 9:15, more than an hour after their usual Saturday night closing time, Rose ushered the final patrons out. Barbie locked the door and turned the sign from open to closed. He watched those last 4 or 5 cross the street to the town common, where there were as many as 50 people gathered and talking among themselves. They were facing south, where a great white light formed a bubble over 119. Not TV lights, Barbie judged. That was the U.S. Army, creating and securing a perimeter. And how did you secure a perimeter at night? Why, by posting sentries and lighting the dead zone, of course. Dead zone. He didn't like the sound of that. Main Street, on the other hand, was unnaturally dark. There were electric lights shining in some of the buildings, where there were Jennies at work, and battery-powered emergency lights shining in Burpee's department store, the gas and grocery, Mill New and Used Books, Food City at the foot of Main Street Hill, and half a dozen others. But the streetlights were dark, and there were candles shining in the windows of most of Main Street's second-floor windows, where there were apartments. Rose sat at a table in the middle of the room, smoking a cigarette, Illegal in public buildings, but Barbie would never tell. She pulled the net off her head and gave Barbie a wan smile as he sat down across from her. Behind them, Anson was swabbing the counter, his own shoulder-length hair now liberated from its Red Sox cap.
"I thought 4th of July was bad, but this was worse," Rose said. "If you hadn't turned up, I'd be curled in the corner screaming for my mommy."
There was a blonde in an F-150, Barbie said, smiling at the memory. She almost gave me a ride. If she had, I might have been out. On the other hand, what happened to Chuck Thompson and the woman in that airplane with him might have happened to me. Thompson's name had been part of CNN's coverage. The woman hadn't been identified. But Rose knew.
"It was Claudette Sanders. I'm almost sure it was. Dodie told me yesterday that her mom had a lesson today."
There was a plate of French fries between them on the table. Barbie had been reaching for one. Now he stopped. All at once, he didn't want any more fries. Any more of anything. And the red puddle on the side of the plate looked more like blood than ketchup. So that's why Dodie didn't come in. Rose shrugged.
"Maybe. I can't say for sure. I haven't heard from her. Didn't really expect to with the phones out."
Barbie assumed she meant the landlines, but even from the kitchen he'd heard people complaining about trouble getting through on their cells. Most assumed it was because everyone was trying to use them at the same time, jamming the band. Some thought the influx of TV people, probably hundreds by this time, toting Nokias, Motorolas, iPhones, and Blackberries, was causing the problem. Barbie had darker suspicions. This was a national security situation, after all, in a time when the whole country was paranoid about terrorism. Some calls were getting through, but fewer and fewer as the evening went on.
"Of course," Rose said, "Dodes might also have taken it into that airhead of hers to blow off work and go to the Auburn Mall."
"Does Mr. Sanders know it was Claudette in the plane?"
"I can't say for sure, but I'd be awfully surprised if he doesn't know by now."
And she sang, in a small but tuneful voice.
"It's a small town, you know what I mean?"
Barbie smiled a little and sang the next line back to her. "Just a small town, baby. And we all support the team." It was from an old James McMurtry song that had the previous summer gained a new and mysterious 2-month vogue on a couple of Western Maine C&W stations. Not WCIK, of course. James McMurtry was not the sort of artist Jesus Radio supported. Rose pointed to the French fries.
"You gonna eat any more of those?"
"Nope. Lost my appetite." Barbie had no great love for either the endlessly grinning Andy Sanders or for Dodie the Dim, who had almost certainly helped her good friend Angie spread the rumor that had caused Barbie's trouble at Dippers. But the idea that those body parts... it was the green-clad leg his mind's eye kept trying to look at. Had belonged to Dodie's mother, the first selectman's wife.
"Me too,"
Rose said, and put her cigarette out in the ketchup. It made a sound, and for one awful moment Barbie thought he was going to throw up. He turned his head and gazed out the window onto Main Street, although there was nothing to see from in here. From in here it was all dark.
"President's going to speak at midnight," Anson announced from the counter.
From behind him came the low, constant groan of the dishwasher. It occurred to Barbie that the big old Hobart might be doing its last chore, at least for a while. He would have to convince Rosie of that. She'd be reluctant, but she'd see sense. She was a bright and practical woman. Dodie Sanders' mother, Jesus, what are the odds? He realized that the odds were actually not that bad. If it hadn't been Mrs. Sanders, it might well have been someone else he knew. "It's a small town, baby, and we all support the team."
"No president for me tonight," Rose said. "He'll have to God bless America on his own. 5 o'clock comes early."
Sweetbriar Rose didn't open until 7 on Sunday mornings, but there was prep, always prep, and on Sundays that included cinnamon rolls.
"You boys stay up and watch if you want to. Just make sure we're locked up tight when you leave, front and back."
She started to rise. "Rose, we need to talk about tomorrow," Barbie said.
"Fiddle-dee-dee, tomorrow is another day. Let it go for now, Barbie, all in good time."
But she must have seen something on his face because she sat back down.
"All right, why the grim look?"
"When's the last time you got propane?"
"Last week, we're almost full. Is that all you're worried about?"
It wasn't, but it was where his worries started. Barbie calculated. Sweetbriar Rose had two tanks hooked together. Each tank had a capacity of either 325 or 350 gallons. He couldn't remember which. He'd check in the morning. But if Rose was right, she had over 600 gallons on hand. That was good. A bit of luck on a day that had been spectacularly unlucky for the town as a whole. But there was no way of knowing how much bad luck could still be ahead. And 600 gallons of propane wouldn't last forever. "What's the burn rate?" he asked her. "Any idea?"
"Why does that matter?"
"Because right now your generator is running this place. Lights, stoves, fridges, pumps. The furnace, too, if it gets cold enough to kick on tonight. And the Jenny is eating propane to do it." They were quiet for a moment, listening to the steady roar of the almost new Honda behind the restaurant. Anson Wheeler came over and sat down. "The Jenny sucks 2 gallons of propane an hour at 60% utilization," he said. "How do you know that?" Barbie asked. "Read it on the tag. Running everything like we have since around noon, when the power went out, it probably ate 3 an hour, maybe a little more." Rose's response was immediate. "Ants, kill all the lights but the ones in the kitchen, right now, and turn the furnace thermostat down to 50. She considered. "No, turn it off." Barbie smiled and gave her a thumbs up. She got it. Not everyone in the mill would. Not everyone in the mill would want to. "Okay." But Anson looked doubtful. "You don't think by tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon at the latest?" "The President of the United States is going to make a TV speech," Barbie said. "At midnight. What do you think, Ants?" "I think I better turn off the lights," he said.
"And the thermostat, don't forget that," Rose said.
As he hurried away, she said to Barbie, "I'll do the same in my place when I go up." A widow for 10 years or more, she lived over her restaurant. Barbie nodded. He had turned over one of the paper placemats. "Have you visited these 20 main landmarks?" And was figuring on the back. 27 to 30 gallons of propane burned since the barrier went up. That left 570. If Rose could cut her use back to 25 gallons a day, she could theoretically keep going for 3 weeks. Cut back to 20 gallons a day, which she could probably do by closing between breakfast and lunch, and again between lunch and dinner, and she could press on for nearly a month. "Which is fine enough," he thought, "because if this town isn't open again after a month, there won't be anything here to cook anyway."
"What are you thinking?" Rose asked. "And what's up with those numbers? I have no idea what they mean."
"Because you're looking at them upside down," Barbie said, and realized everyone in town was apt to do the same. These were figures no one would want to look at right side up. Rose turned Barbie's makeshift scratch pad toward her. She ran the numbers for herself. Then she raised her head and looked at Barbie, shocked. At that moment, Anson turned most of the lights out, and the two of them were staring at each other in a gloom that was, to Barbie at least, horribly persuasive. They could be in real trouble here.
28 days, she asked. "You think we need to plan for 4 weeks?
"I don't know if we do or not, but when I was in Iraq, someone gave me a copy of Chairman Mao's little red book. I carried it around in my pocket, read it cover to cover. Most of it makes more sense than our politicians do on their sanest days. One thing that stuck with me was this: wish for sunshine but build dikes. I think that's what we, she said, and touched his hand. He turned his over and clasped it. "Okay, we. I think that's what we have to plan for, which means closing between meals, cutting back on the ovens, no cinnamon rolls, even though I love them as much as anybody, and no dishwasher. It's old and energy inefficient. I know Dodie and Anson won't love the idea of washing dishes by hand."
"I don't think we can count on Dodie coming back soon, maybe not at all. Not with her mother dead."
Rose sighed.
"I almost hope she did go to the Auburn Mall. Although I suppose it'll be in the papers tomorrow."
"Maybe." Barbie had no idea how much information was going to come out of or into Chester's Mill if this situation didn't resolve quickly and with some rational explanation. Probably not much. He thought Maxwell Smart's fabled cone of silence would descend soon, if it hadn't already. Anson came back to the table where Barbie and Rose were sitting. He had his jacket on. "Is it okay for me to go now, Rose?" sure, she said. 6 tomorrow?
Isn't that a little late?
He grinned and added, not that I'm complaining.
We're going to open late, she hesitated, and close between meals.
Really? Cool.
His gaze shifted to Barbie.
You got a place to stay tonight because you can stay with me. Seda went to Derry to visit her folks.
Seda was Anson's wife. Barbie, in fact, did have a place to go. Almost directly across the street. Thanks, but I'll go back to my apartment. I'm paid up until the end of the month, so why not? I dropped off the keys with Petra Searles in the drugstore before I left this morning, but I still have a dupe on my key ring.
Okay, see you in the morning, Rose.
Will you be here, Barbie?
Wouldn't miss it.
Anson's grin widened.
Excellent.
When he was gone, Rose rubbed her eyes, then looked at Barbie grimly.
How long is this going to go on? Best guess.
I don't have a best guess because I don't know what happened or when it will stop happening.
Very low, Rose said.
Barbie, you're scaring me.
I'm scaring myself. We both need to go to bed. Things will look better in the morning.
After this discussion, I'll probably need an Ambien to get to sleep, she said. Tired as I am, but thank God you came back.
Barbie remembered what he'd been thinking about supplies. One other thing. If Food City opens tomorrow...
It's always open on Sundays, 10 to 6.
If it opens tomorrow, you need to go shopping.
But Cisco delivers on...
She broke off and stared at him dismally.
On Tuesdays. But we can't count on that, can we? Of course not.
No, he said. Even if what's wrong suddenly becomes right, the army's apt to quarantine this burg. At least for a while.
What should I buy?
Everything, but especially meat. Meat, meat, meat. If the store opens, I'm not sure it will. Jim Rennie may persuade whoever manages it now.
Jack Cale, he took over when Ernie Calvert retired last year.
Well, Rennie may persuade him to close until further notice, or get Chief Perkins to order the place closed.
You don't know, Rose asked, and at his blank look. You don't. Duke Perkins is dead, Bobby. He died out there.
She gestured south. Barbie stared at her, stunned. Anson had neglected to turn off the television, and behind them, Rose's Wolfie was again telling the world that an unexplained force had cut off a small town in western Maine. The area had been isolated by the armed forces. The Joint Chiefs were meeting in Washington. The president would address the nation at midnight. But in the meantime, he was asking the American people to unite their prayers for the people of Chester's Mill with his own. 3.
Dad.
Dad. Junior Rennie stood at the top of the stairs, head cocked, listening. There was no response, and the TV was silent. His dad was always home from work, and in front of the TV by now. On Saturday nights, he forewent CNN and Fox News for either Animal Planet or the History Channel. Not tonight, though. Junior listened to his watch to make sure it was still ticking. It was. And what it said sort of made sense, because it was dark outside. A terrible thought occurred to him. Big Jim might be with Chief Perkins. The two of them could at this minute be discussing how to arrest Junior with the least possible fuss. And why had they waited so long? So they could spirit him out of town under cover of darkness. Take him to the county jail over in Castle Rock. Then a trial. And then... Then Shawshank. After a few years there, he'd probably just call it the Shank, like the rest of the murderers, robbers, and sodomites. That's stupid, he whispered. But was it? He'd awakened thinking that killing Angie had just been a dream. Must have been, because he would never kill anyone. Beat them up, maybe, but kill? Ridiculous. He was, a regular person. Then he'd looked at the clothes under the bed, seen the blood on them, and it all came back. The towel falling off her hair, her pussy patch somehow goading him. The complicated crunching sound from behind her face when he'd gotten her with his knee. The rain of fridge magnets, and the way she had thrashed. But that wasn't me, it was the headache. Yes, true, but who'd believe that? He'd have better luck if he said the butler did it.
Dad!
Nothing. Not here. Not at the police station, conspiring against him either. Not his dad. He wouldn't. His dad always said family came first. But did family come first? Of course he said that. He was a Christian, after all, and half-owner of WCIK. But Junior had an idea that for his dad, Jim Rennie's used cars might come before family, and that being the town's first selectman might come before the holy tabernacle of no money down. Junior could be, it was possible, third in line. He realized for the first time in his life it was a genuine flash of insight, that he was only guessing, that he might not really know his father at all. He went back to his room and turned on the overhead. It cast an odd, unsteady light, waxing bright and then dim. For a moment, Junior thought something was wrong with his eyes. Then he realized he could hear their generator running out back. And not just theirs, either. The town's power was out. He felt a surge of relief. A big power outage explained everything. It meant his father was likely in the town hall conference room, discussing matters with those other two idiots, Sanders and Grinnell. Maybe sticking pins in the big map of the town, making like George Patton, yelling at Western Maine Power and calling them a bunch of lazy cotton pickers. Junior got his bloody clothes, raked the shit out of his jeans, wallet, change, keys, comb, and extra headache pill, and redistributed it in the pockets of his clean pants. He hurried downstairs, stuck the incriminating garments in the washer, set it for hot, then reconsidered, remembering something his mother had told him when he was no more than 10, cold water for bloodstains. As he moved the dial to cold wash, cold rinse, Junior wondered idly if his dad had started his hobby of secretary fucking way back then, or if he was still keeping his cotton-picking penis at home. He started the washer going and thought about what to do next. With the headache gone, he found that he could think. He decided he should go back to Angie's house after all. He didn't want to. God almighty, it was the last thing he wanted to do. But he probably should scope out the scene, walk past and see how many police cars were there. Also, whether or not the Castle County forensics van was there. Forensics was key. He knew that from watching CSI. He'd seen the big blue and white van before, while visiting the county courthouse with his dad. And if it was at the McCain's, I'll run. Yes, as fast and far as he could. But before he did, he'd come back here and visit the safe in his dad's study. His dad didn't think Junior knew the combo to that safe, but Junior did, just as he knew the password to his dad's computer, and thus about his dad's penchant for watching what Junior and Frank the Lesseps called Oreo sex. Two black chicks, one white guy. There was plenty of money in that safe. Thousands of dollars. What if you see the van and come back and he's here? The money first, then. The money right now. He went into the study and for a moment thought he saw his father sitting in the high back chair where he watched the news and nature programs. He'd fallen asleep, or what if he'd had a heart attack? Big Jim had had heart problems off and on for the last 3 years. Mostly arrhythmia. He usually went up to Kathy Russell and either Doc Haskell or Doc Rayburn buzzed him with something and got him back to normal. Haskell would have been content to keep on doing that forever. But Rayburn, whom his father called an overeducated cotton picker, had finally insisted that Big Jim see a cardiologist at CMG in Lewiston. The cardiologist said he needed a procedure to knock out that irregular heartbeat once and for all. Big Jim, who was terrified of hospitals, said he needed to talk to God more, and you called that a prayer procedure. Meantime, he took his pills, and for the last few months he'd seemed fine, but now, maybe... Dad? No answer. Junior flipped the light switch. The overhead gave that same unsteady glow, but it dispelled the shadow Junior had taken for the back of his father's head. He wouldn't be exactly heartbroken if his dad vapor-locked, but on the whole he was glad it hadn't happened tonight. There was such a thing as too many complications. Still, he walked to the wall where the safe was, with big, soft steps of cartoon caution, watching for the splash of headlights across the window that would herald his father's return. He set aside the picture that covered the safe, Jesus giving the Sermon on the Mount, and ran the combination. He had to do it twice before the handle would turn, because his hands were shaking. The safe was stuffed with cash and stacks of parchment-like sheets with the words "Bearer Bonds" stamped on them. Junior gave a low whistle. The last time he'd opened this, to filch 50 for last year's Freiburg fair, there had been plenty of cash, but nowhere near this much. and no bearer bonds. He thought of the plaque on his father's desk at the car store. Would Jesus approve of this deal? Even in his distress and fear, Junior found time to wonder if Jesus would approve of whatever deal his dad had going on the side these days. Never mind his business, I gotta run mine, he said in a low voice. He took 550s and 20s, started to close the safe, reconsidered, and took some of the hundreds as well. Given the obscene glut of cash in there, his dad might not even miss it. If he did, it was possible he'd understand why Junior had taken it, and might approve. As Big Jim always said, the Lord helps those who help themselves. In that spirit, Junior helped himself to another 400. Then he closed the safe, spun the combo, and hung Jesus back on the wall. He grabbed a jacket from the front hall closet and went out while the generator roared and the Maytag sudsed Angie's blood from his clothes. 4. There was no one at the McCain's house. Fucking no one. Junior lurked on the other side of the street in a moderate shower of maple leaves, wondering if he could trust what he was seeing. The house, dark, Henry McCain's 4Runner and LaDonna's Prius, still not in evidence. It seemed too good to be true, far too good. Maybe they were on the town common. A lot of people were tonight. Possibly they were discussing the power failure, although Junior couldn't remember any such gatherings before when the lights went out. People mostly went home and went to bed, sure that, unless there'd been a whopper of a storm, the lights would be back on when they got up for breakfast. Maybe this power failure had been caused by some spectacular accident, the kind of thing the TV news broke into regular coverage to report. Junior had a vague memory of some geezer asking him what was going on not long after Angie had her own accident. In any case, Junior had taken care to speak to nobody on his way over here. He had walked along Main Street with his head down and his collar turned up. He had, in fact, almost bumped into Anson Wheeler as Ants left Sweetbriar Rose. The streetlights were out, and that helped preserve his anonymity. Another gift from the gods. And now this. A third gift. A gigantic one. Was it really possible that Angie's body hadn't been discovered yet? Or was he looking at a trap? Junior could picture the Castle County Sheriff or a state police detective saying, "We only have to keep out of sight and wait, boys. The killer always revisits the scene of his crime. It's a well-known fact." TV bullshit. Still, as he crossed the street, drawn, it seemed, by a force outside himself, Junior kept expecting spotlights to go on, pinning him like a butterfly on a piece of cardboard. Kept expecting someone to shout, probably through a bullhorn, "Stop where you are and get those hands in the air." Nothing happened. When he reached the foot of the McCain driveway, heart skittering in his chest and blood thumping in his temples. Still no headache, though, and that was good, a good sign. The house remained dark and silent. Not even a generator roaring, although there was one at the Grinnells next door. Junior looked over his shoulder and saw a vast white bubble of light rising above the trees. Something at the south end of town, or perhaps over in Motton. The source of the accident that had killed the power? Probably. He went to the back door. The front door would still be unlocked if no one had returned since Angie's accident, but he didn't want to go in the front. He would if he had to, but maybe he wouldn't. He was, after all, on a roll. The doorknob turned. Junior stuck his head into the kitchen and smelled the blood at once. An odor a little like spray starch, only gone stale. He said, "Hi. Hello. Anybody home?" Almost positive there wasn't. But if someone was, if by some crazy chance Henry or LaDonna had parked over by the common and returned on foot, somehow missing their daughter lying dead on the kitchen floor, he would scream. Yes, scream, and discover the body. That wouldn't do anything about the dreaded forensics van, but it would buy him a little time. "Hello? Mr. McCain? Mrs. McCain?" And then, in a flash of inspiration, "Angie, are you home?" Would he call her like that if he'd killed her? Of course not. But then a terrible thought lanced through him. What if she answered? answered from where she was lying on the floor. Answered through a throat full of blood.
Get a grip, he muttered.
Yes, he had to, but it was hard. Especially in the dark. Besides, in the Bible, stuff like that happened all the time. In the Bible, people sometimes return to life like the zombies in Night of the Living Dead.
Anybody home?
Zip.
Nada.
His eyes had adjusted to the gloom, but not enough. He needed a light. He should have brought a flashlight from the house, but it was easy to forget stuff like that when you were used to just flipping a switch. Junior crossed the kitchen, stepping over Angie's body, and opened the first of two doors on the far side. It was a pantry. He could just make out the shelves of bottled and canned goods. He tried the other door and had better luck. It was the laundry. And unless he was mistaken about the shape of the thing standing on the shelf just to his right, he was still on a roll. He wasn't mistaken. It was a flashlight, a nice bright one. He'd have to be careful about shining it around the kitchen. Easing down the shades would be an excellent idea. But in the laundry room, he could shine it around to his heart's content. In here, he was fine. Soap powder, bleach, fabric softener, a bucket, and a Swiffer. Good. With no generator, there'd only be cold water, but there would probably be enough to fill one bucket from the taps. And then, of course, there were the various toilet tanks. And cold was what he wanted. Cold for blood. He would clean like the demon housekeeper his mother had once been, mindful of her husband's exhortation. Clean house, clean hands, clean heart. He would clean up the blood. Then he'd wipe everything he could remember touching and everything he might have touched without remembering. But first, the body. He had to do something with the body. Junior decided the pantry would do for the time being. He dragged her in by the arms, then let them go.
Flump.
After that, he set to work. He sang under his breath as he first replaced the fridge magnets, then drew the shades. He had filled the bucket almost to the top before the faucet started spitting. Another bonus. He was still scrubbing, the work well begun, but nowhere near done, when the knock came at the front door. Junior looked up, eyes wide, lips drawn back in a humorless grin of horror.
Angie?
It was a girl, and she was sobbing.
Angie? Are you there?
More knocking, and then the door opened. His role, it seemed, was over.
Angie, please be here. I saw your car in the garage.
Shit, the garage. He never checked the fucking garage.
Angie?
Sobbing again.
Someone he knew. Oh, God, was it that idiot Dodie Sanders?
It was.
Angie, she said my mom's dead. Mrs. Shumway said that she died.
Junior hoped she'd go upstairs first, check Angie's room, but she came down the hall toward the kitchen instead, moving slowly and tentatively in the dark.
Angie, are you in the kitchen? I thought I saw a light.
Junior's head was starting to ache again, and it was this interfering, dope-smoking cunt's fault. Whatever happened next, that would be her fault, too. 5. Dodie Sanders was still a little stoned and a little drunk. She was hungover. Her mother was dead. She was fumbling up the hall of her best friend's house in the dark. She stepped on something that slid away under her foot and almost went ass over teapot. She grabbed at the stair railing, bent two of her fingers painfully back, and cried out. She sort of understood all this was happening to her, but at the same time, it was impossible to believe. She felt as if she'd wandered into some parallel dimension, like in a science fiction movie. She bent to see what had nearly spilled her. It looked like a towel. Some fool had left a towel on the front hall floor. Then she thought she heard someone moving in the darkness up ahead, in the kitchen.
Angie, is that you?
Nothing. She still felt someone was there, but maybe not.
Angie?
She shuffled forward again, holding her throbbing right hand. Her fingers were going to swell. She thought they were swelling already, against her side. She held her left hand out before her, feeling the dark air.
Angie, please be there. My mother's dead. It's not a joke. Mrs. Shumway told me, and she doesn't joke. I need you.
The day had started so well. She'd been up early. Well, 10, early for her, and she'd had no intention of blowing off work. Then Samantha Bushy had called to say she'd gotten some new brats on eBay and to ask if Dodie wanted to come over and help torture them. Brats torture was something they'd gotten into in high school. Buy them at yard sales, then hang them, pound nails into their stupid little heads, douse them with lighter fluid, and set them on fire. And Dodie knew they should have grown out of it. They were adults now. Or almost. It was kid stuff. Also a little creepy, when you really thought about it. But the thing was, Sammy had her own place out on the Motton Road. Just a trailer, but all hers since her husband had taken off in the spring. And little Walter slept practically all day. Plus, Sammy usually had bitchin' weed. Dodie guessed she got it from the guys she partied with. Her trailer was a popular place on the weekends. But the thing was, Dodie had sworn off weed. Never again, not since all that trouble with the cook. Never again. Had lasted over a week on the day Sammy called.
"You can have Jade and Yasmin," Sammy coaxed. "Also, I've got some great you-know."
She always said that, as if someone listening in wouldn't know what she was talking about.
"Also, we can, you know."
Dodie knew what that you-know was, too. Then she felt a little tingle down there in her you-know, even though that was also kid stuff, and they should have left it behind long ago.
"I don't think so, Sam. I have to be at work at 2, and..." "Yasmin awaits," Sammy said, "and you know you hate that bitch."
Well, that was true. Yasmin was the bitchiest of the brats, in Dodie's opinion. And it was almost 4 hours until 2 o'clock. Further, and if she was a little late, so what? Was Rose going to fire her? Who else would work that shit job?
"Okay, but just for a little while, and only because I hate Yasmin."
Sammy giggled.
"But I don't, you know, anymore. Either you know." "Not a problem," Sammy said. "Come quick."
So Dodie had driven out, and of course she discovered Brat's torture was no fun if you weren't a little high. So she got a little high, and so did Sammy. They collaborated on giving Yasmin some drain cleaner plastic surgery, which was pretty hilarious. Then Sammy wanted to show her this sweet new camisole she'd gotten at Deb, and although Sam was getting a little bit of a pot belly, she still looked good to Dodie, perhaps because they were a little bit stoned. Wrecked, in fact. And since little Walter was still asleep, his father had insisted on naming the kid after some old blues man, and all that sleeping, yow, Dodie had an idea little Walter was retarded, which would be no surprise, given the amount of rope Sam had smoked while carrying him. They ended up getting into Sammy's bed and doing a little of the old you know. Afterward, they'd fallen asleep, and when Dodie woke up, little Walter was blatting, "Holy shit, call News Center 6, and it was past 5. Really, too late to go into work. And besides, Sam had produced a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, and they had 1 shot, 2 shot, 3 shot, 4, and Sammy decided she wanted to see what happened to a baby brats in the microwave. Only the power was out. Dodie had crept back to town at roughly 16 miles an hour, still high and paranoid as hell, constantly checking the rearview mirror for cops, knowing if she did get stopped, it would be by that red-haired bitch, Jackie Weddington. Or her father would be taking a break from the store and he'd smell the booze on her breath. Or her mother would be home, so tired out from her stupid flying lesson that she had decided to stay home from the Eastern Star bingo.
"Please, God," she prayed, "please get me through this and I'll never, you know, again. Either, you know, never in this life."
God heard her prayer. Nobody was home. The power was out here, too, but in her altered state, Dodie hardly noticed. She crept upstairs to her room, shucked out of her pants and shirt, and laid down in her bed. Just for a few minutes, she told herself. Then she put her clothes, which smelled of ganja, in the washer and put herself in the shower. She smelled of Sammy's perfume, which she must buy a gallon at a time down at Burpee's. Only she couldn't set the alarm with the power out, and when the knocking at the door woke her up, it was dark. She grabbed a robe and went downstairs, suddenly sure that it would be the red-headed cop with the big boobs, ready to put her under arrest for driving under the influence. Maybe for crack snacking, too. Dodie didn't think that particular you-know was against the law, but she wasn't entirely sure. It wasn't Jackie Weddington, it was Julia Shumway, the editor-publisher of The Democrat. She had a flashlight in one hand. She shined it in Dodie's face, which was probably puffed with sleep, her eyes surely still red and her hair a haystack, and then lowered it again. Enough light kicked up to show Julia's own face, and Dodie saw a sympathy there that made her feel confused and afraid. "Poor kid," Julia said. "You don't know, do you?"
"Don't know what?"
Dodie had asked. It was around then that the parallel universe feeling had started.
"Don't know what?"
And Julia Shumway had told her. 6.
Angie, please.
Fumbling her way up the hall, hand throbbing, head throbbing, she could have looked for her father. Mrs. Shumway had offered to take her, starting at Bowie Funeral Home, but her blood ran cold at the thought of that place. Besides, it was Angie that she wanted, Angie who would hug her tight with no interest in the you-know, Angie who was her best friend. A shadow came out of the kitchen and moved swiftly toward her.
"There you are, thank God."
She began to sob harder and hurried toward the figure with her arms outstretched.
"Oh, it's awful. I'm being punished for being a bad girl. I know I am."
The dark figure stretched out its own arms, but they did not enfold Dodie in a hug. Instead, the hands at the end of those arms closed around her throat. The good of the town, the good of the people. 1. Andy Sanders was indeed at the Bowie Funeral Home. He had walked there, toting a heavy load, bewilderment, grief, a broken heart. He was sitting in Remembrance Parlor 1, his only company in the coffin at the front of the room. Gertrude Evans, 87, or maybe 88, had died of congestive heart failure 2 days before. Andy had sent a condolence note, although God knew who'd eventually receive it. Gert's husband had died a decade ago. It didn't matter. He always sent condolences when one of his constituents died, handwritten on a sheet of cream stationery reading, "From the desk of the first selectman." He felt it was part of his duty. Big Jim couldn't be bothered with such things. Big Jim was too busy running what he called our business, by which he meant Chester's Mill. Ran it like his own private railroad, in point of fact, but Andy had never resented this. He understood that Big Jim was smart. Andy understood something else as well. Without Andrew Delois Sanders, Big Jim probably couldn't have been elected dog catcher. Big Jim could sell used cars by promising eye-watering deals, low financing and premiums like cheap Korean vacuum cleaners. But when he tried to get the Toyota dealership that time, the company had settled on Will Freeman instead. Given his sales figures and location out on 119, Big Jim hadn't been able to understand how Toyota could be so stupid. Andy could. He maybe wasn't the brightest bear in the woods, but he knew Big Jim had no warmth. He was a hard man. Some, those who'd come a cropper and all that low financing, for instance, would have said hard-hearted. And he was persuasive, but he was also chilly. Andy, on the other hand, had warmth to spare. When he went around town at election time, Andy told folks that he and Big Jim were like the Doublemint twins, or Click and Clack, or Peanut Butter and Jelly. And Chester's Mill wouldn't be the same without both of them in harness, along with whichever third happened to be currently along for the ride. Right now, Rose Twitchell's sister, Andrea Grinnell. Andy had always enjoyed his partnership with Big Jim. Financially, yes. Especially during the last 2 or 3 years, but also in his heart. Big Jim knew how to get things done, and why they should be done. "We're in this for the long haul," he'd say. "We're doing it for the town, for the people, for their own good." And that was good. Doing good was good. But now, tonight, "I hated those flying lessons from the first," he said, and began to cry again. Soon he was sobbing noisily. But that was all right, because Brenda Perkins had left in silent tears after viewing the remains of her husband, and the Bowie brothers were downstairs. They had a lot of work to do. Andy understood in a vague way that something very bad had happened. Fern Bowie had gone out for a bite at Sweetbriar Rose, and when he came back, Andy was sure Fern would kick him out, but Fern passed down the hall without even looking in at where Andy sat with his hands between his knees and his tie loosened and his hair in disarray.
Fern had descended to what he and his brother Stuart called the workroom. Horrible. Horrible. Duke Perkins was down there. Also that damned old Chuck Thompson, who maybe hadn't talked his wife into those flying lessons, but sure hadn't talked her out of them either. Maybe others were down there, too. Claudette, for sure. Andy voiced a watery groan and clasped his hands together more tightly. He couldn't live without her. No way could he live without her. And not just because he'd loved her more than his own life. It was Claudette, along with regular unreported and ever larger cash infusions from Jim Rennie, who kept the drugstore going. On his own, Andy would have run it into bankruptcy before the turn of the century. His specialty was people, not accounts and ledgers. His wife was the numbers specialist. Or had been. As the past perfect clanged in his mind, Andy groaned again. Claudette and Big Jim had even collaborated on fixing up the town's books that time when the state audited them. It was supposed to be a surprise audit, but Big Jim had gotten advance word. Not much, just enough for them to go to work with the computer program Claudette called Mr. Clean. They called it that because it always produced clean numbers. They'd come out of that audit shiny side up, instead of going to jail. Which wouldn't have been fair, since most of what they were doing, almost all, in fact, was for the town's own good. The truth about Claudette Sanders was this. She'd been a prettier Jim Rennie. A kinder Jim Rennie. One he could sleep with, and tell his secrets to. And life without her was unthinkable. Andy started to tear up again. And that was when Big Jim himself put a hand on his shoulder and squeezed. Andy hadn't heard him come in, but he didn't jump. He had almost expected the hand, because its owner always seemed to turn up when Andy needed him the most. "I thought I'd find you here," Big Jim said. "Andy, pal, I'm just so, so sorry." Andy lurched to his feet, groped his arms around Big Jim's bulk, and began to sob against Big Jim's jacket.
"I told her those lessons were dangerous. I told her Chuck Thompson was a jackass, just like his father."
Big Jim rubbed his back with a soothing palm. "I know, but she's in a better place now, Andy. She had dinner with Jesus Christ tonight. Roast beef, fresh peas, mashed with gravy. How's that for an awesome thought? You hang on to that. I think we should pray."
"Yes," Andy sobbed. "Yes, Big Jim. Pray with me."
They got on their knees, and Big Jim prayed long and hard for the soul of Claudette Sanders. Below them in the workroom, Stuart Bowie heard, looked up at the ceiling, and observed, "That man shits from both ends." After 4 or 5 minutes of "We see through a glass darkly," and "When I was a child, I spake as a child," Andy didn't quite see the relevance of that one, but didn't care. It was comforting just to be knee-bound with Big Jim. Rennie finished up, "For Jesus' sake, amen," and helped Andy to his feet. Face to face and bosom to bosom, Big Jim grasped Andy by the upper arms and looked into his eyes. "So, partner," he said. He always called Andy partner when the situation was serious. "Are you ready to go to work?" Andy stared at him dumbly. Big Jim nodded as if Andy had made a reasonable, under the circumstances, protest. "I know it's hard, not fair, inappropriate time to ask you, and you'd be within your rights. God knows you would, if you were to bust me one right in the cotton-picking chops. But sometimes we have to put the welfare of others first. Isn't that true?"
"The good of the town," Andy said.
For the first time since getting the news about Claudie, he saw a sliver of light. Big Jim nodded. His face was solemn, but his eyes were shining. Andy had a strange thought. He looks 10 years younger. "Right you are. We're custodians, partner. Custodians of the common good. Not always easy, but never unnecessary. I sent the Weddington woman to hunt up Andrea.
told her to bring Andrea to the conference room, in handcuffs, if that's what it takes. Big Jim laughed. She'll be there. And Pete Randolph's making a list of all the available town cops. Aren't enough. We've got to address that, partner. If this situation goes on, authority's going to be key. So what do you say? Can you suit up for me? Andy nodded. He thought it might take his mind off this. Even if it didn't, he needed to make like a bee and buzz. Looking at Gert Evans' coffin was beginning to give him the willies. The silent tears of the chief's widow had given him the willies, too. And it wouldn't be hard. All he really needed to do was sit there at the conference table and raise his hand when Big Jim raised his. Andrea Grinnell, who never seemed entirely awake, would do the same. If emergency measures of some sort needed to be implemented, Big Jim would see that they were. Big Jim would take care of everything.
"Let's go,"
Andy replied. Big Jim clapped him on the back, slung an arm over Andy's thin shoulders, and led him out of the remembrance parlor. It was a heavy arm, meaty, but it felt good. He never even thought of his daughter. In his grief, Andy Sanders had forgotten her entirely. 2. Julia Shumway walked slowly down Commonwealth Street, home of the town's wealthiest residents, toward Main Street. Happily divorced for 10 years, she lived over the offices of the Democrat with Horace, her elderly Welsh corgi. She had named him after the great Mr. Greeley, who was remembered for a single bon mot, "Go west, young man, go west," but whose real claim to fame, in Julia's mind, was his work as a newspaper editor. If Julia could do work half as good as Greeley's on the New York Trib, she would consider herself a success. Of course, her Horace always considered her a success, which made him the nicest dog on earth, in Julia's book. She would walk him as soon as she got home, then enhance herself further in his eyes by scattering a few pieces of last night's steak on top of his kibble. That would make them both feel good. And she wanted to feel good about something, anything, because she was troubled. This was not a new state for her. She had lived in the mill for all of her 43 years, and in the last 10, she liked what she saw in her hometown less and less. She worried about the inexplicable decay of the town's sewer system and waste treatment plant in spite of all the money that had been poured into them. She worried about the impending closure of Cloud Top, the town's ski resort. She worried that James Rennie was stealing even more from the town till than she suspected, and she suspected he had been stealing a great deal for decades. And of course she was worried about this new thing, which seemed to her almost too big to comprehend. Every time she tried to get a handle on it, her mind would fix on some part that was small but concrete. Her increasing inability to place calls on her cell phone, for instance. And she hadn't received a single one, which was very troubling. Never mind concerned friends and relatives outside of town trying to get in touch. She should have been jammed up with calls from other papers. The Lewiston Sun, the Portland Press Herald, perhaps even the New York Times. Was everyone else in the mill having the same problems? She should go out to the Motton Town Line and see for herself. If she couldn't use her phone to buzz Pete Freeman, her best photographer, she could take some pics herself with what she called her emergency Nikon. She had heard there was now some sort of quarantine zone in place on the Motton and Tarker's Mills side of the barrier, probably the other towns as well, but surely she could get close on this side. They could warn her off, but if the barrier was as impermeable as she was hearing, warning would be the extent of it. "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me," she said. Absolutely true. If words could hurt her, Jim Rennie would have had her in ICU after the story she'd written about that joke audit the state had pulled 3 years ago. Certainly he'd blabbed a plenty-o about suing the paper. But blabbing was all it had been. She had even briefly considered an editorial on the subject, mostly because she had a terrific headline, "Supposed Suit Slips from Sight." So, yes, she had worries. They came with the job. What she wasn't used to worrying about was her own behavior, and now, standing on the corner of Main and Calm, she was. Instead of turning left on Main, she looked back the way she had come, and spoke in the low murmur she usually reserved for Horace.
"I shouldn't have left that girl alone."
Julia would not have done if she'd come in her car, but she'd come on foot, and besides, Dodie had been so insistent. There had been a smell about her, too. Pot? Maybe. Not that Julia had any strong objections to that. She had smoked her own share over the years, and maybe it would calm the girl, take the edge off her grief while it was sharpest and most likely to cut.
"Don't worry about me," Dodie had said. "I'll find my dad, but first I have to dress,"
and indicated the robe she was wearing.
"I'll wait,"
Julia had replied, although she didn't want to wait. She had a long night ahead of her, beginning with her duty to her dog. Horace must be close to bursting by now, having missed his 5 o'clock walk, and he'd be hungry. When those things were taken care of, she really had to go out to what people were calling the barrier, see it for herself, photograph whatever there was to be photographed. Even that wouldn't be the end. She'd have to see about putting out some sort of extra edition of the Democrat. It was important to her, and she thought it might be important to the town. Of course, all this might be over tomorrow, but Julia had a feeling, partly in her head, partly in her heart, that it wouldn't be. And yet, Dodie Sanders should not have been left alone. She'd seemed to be holding herself together, but that might only have been shock and denial masquerading as calm. And the dope, of course. But she had been coherent.
"You don't need to wait. I don't want you to wait."
"I don't know if being alone right now is wise, dear."
"I'll go to Angie's,"
Dodie said, and seemed to brighten a little at the thought, even as the tears continued to roll down her cheeks.
"She'll go with me to find Daddy," she nodded. "Angie's the one I want."
In Julia's opinion, the McCain girl had only marginally more sense than this one, who had inherited her mother's looks, but unfortunately her father's brains. Angie was a friend, though, and if ever there was a friend in need who needed a friend indeed, it was Dodie Sanders tonight.
"I could go with you."
Not wanting to, knowing that even in her current state of fresh bereavement, the girl could probably see that.
"No, it's only a few blocks."
"Well,
Ms. Shumway, are you sure? Are you sure, my mother?"
Very reluctantly, Julia had nodded. She'd gotten confirmation of the airplane's tail number from Ernie Calvert. She'd gotten something else from him as well, a thing that should more properly have gone to the police. Julia might have insisted that Ernie take it to them, but for the dismaying news that Duke Perkins was dead, and that incompetent weasel Randolph was in charge. What Ernie gave her was Claudette's blood-stained driver's license. It had been in Julia's pocket as she stood on the Sanders stoop, and in her pocket it had stayed. She'd give it either to Andy or to this pale, mussy-haired girl when the right time came. But this was not the time.
"Thank you," Dodie had said in a sadly formal tone of voice. "Now please go away. I don't mean to be crappy about it, but..."
She never finished the thought, only closed the door on it. And what had Julia Shumway done? Obeyed the command of a grief-stricken 20-year-old girl who might be too stoned to be fully responsible for herself. But there were other responsibilities tonight, hard as that was. Horace, for one, and the newspaper. People might make fun of Pete Freeman's grainy black-and-white photos, and the Democrats' exhaustive coverage of such local fêtes as Mill Middle School's enchanted night dance. They might claim its only practical use was as a cat box liner. But they needed it, especially when something bad happened. Julia meant to see that they had it tomorrow, even if she had to stay up all night, which, with both of her regular reporters out of town for the weekend, she probably would. Julia found herself actually looking forward to this challenge, and Dodie Sanders' woeful face began to slip from her mind. 3. Horace looked at her reproachfully when she came in. But there were no damp patches on the carpet and no little brown package under the chair in the hall, a magic spot he seemed to believe invisible to human eyes. She snapped his leash on, took him out, and waited patiently while he pissed by his favorite sewer, tottering as he did it. Horace was 15, old for a corgi. While he went, she stared at the white bubble of light on the southern horizon. It looked to her like an image out of a Steven Spielberg science fiction movie. It was bigger than ever, and she could hear the whoop, whoop, whoop of helicopters, faint but constant. She even saw one in silhouette speeding across that tall arc of brilliance. How many Christing spotlights had they set up out there, anyway? It was as if North Motton had become an LZ in Iraq. Horace was now walking in lazy circles, sniffing out the perfect place to finish tonight's ritual of elimination, doing that ever-popular doggy dance, the poop walk. Julia took the opportunity to try her cell phone again. As had been the case all too often tonight, she got the normal series of peeping tones. And then nothing but silence. I'll have to Xerox the paper, which means 750 copies max. The Democrat hadn't printed its own paper for 20 years. Until 2002, Julia had taken each week's dummy over to View Printing in Castle Rock, and now she didn't even have to do that. She emailed the pages on Tuesday nights, and the finished papers, neatly bound in plastic, were delivered by View Printing before 7 o'clock the next morning. To Julia, who'd grown up dealing with penciled corrections and typewritten copy that was nailed when it was finished, this seemed like magic. And like all magic, slightly untrustworthy. Tonight, the mistrust was justified. She might still be able to email comps to View Printing, but no one would be able to deliver the finished papers in the morning. She guessed that by the morning, nobody would be able to get within 5 miles of the mill's borders, any of its borders. Luckily for her, there was a nice big generator in the former print room.